Sadhana, everybody, welcome to our webinar today. And as usual, we're going to start with the chant, the attunement, Adgare Name. So if will everybody please put your hands together. Adgare Name, Jagadgare Name, Satgare Name, Siri Gurudeve Name, Adgare Name, Jagadgare Name, Satgare Name, Siri Gurudeve Name, Adgare Name, Jagadgare Name, Satgare Name, Siri Gurudeve Name. My Guru. Thank you, everybody. I'm just going to give a couple of updates. A lot of folks were missing Krishna Kaur yesterday and Guru Singh, and I just happened to notice I had an old voicemail from Krishna, a few days old, and out of courtesy, I replied to that. I called her last night, and she expressed her great regret that she couldn't join us. She said, she told me this before, her mama told her, you know, when she gives her word, she has to keep her word, and because of the lawyers, she couldn't keep her word, and she felt badly about that, but she said she's very much with us in spirit, and she wants to stay in touch. I'm thinking maybe we can do a webinar down the road, just have some very clear guidelines about what she can speak on and what she can't. I don't think the lawyers will have a problem with that. So she sends us really her regards. And we are recording every day. And on Friday, there were no difficulties with people accessing the recording. But yesterday, they were. And I got a bunch of feedback. I contacted Zoom, the technical people there. And I think we fixed it. So if you want to chat, text me that you still cannot access that recording, let me know and we'll fix that. And hopefully it's just all fixed. And tonight when we send out the link, it will not be an issue. So that's all the technical stuff, really. So I'll introduce you. We have our distinguished presenters. We have Aftab Singh from Trinidad. We have Nam Kaur, presently in California, I think. Nam Prakash Kaur in York, which is in England. And I'm here in Toronto. And we're going to go alphabetically. So Aftab Singh, please introduce yourself.
Yeah, Satnam, everyone. I am Aftab. You will find me on Facebook as Yogi Aftab. And I started way back in 1972. I won't go into my story of how I got there, but basically I've been pretty much teaching for all those years, and I consider myself to be one of the most devoted students of Yogiji.
Hi, I'm
You're on mute, Nampa.
Sorry, unmuted now. I started also taking yoga in 1973 and moved into an ashram about 6 months later. I presently live in California and knew Yogi Bhajan very well for about 30 years, working with him and going to hundreds of his classes, tantrics, gurdwaras, eating with him in his living room, traveling with him. So I have a lot of stories and incredible memories.
And I'm Nam Prakash Kaur, and I'm a real newbie compared to these beautiful souls with me today. I only found Kundalini Yoga quite a few years after Yogiji passed in 2008. But I did my teacher training in 2009, about 3 months later. So, it's made such a big difference to my life. I have four sons who are home educated. And so right in the middle of home educating them, I found Kundalini Yoga as taught by Yogi Bhajan. And yes, it's really changed their lives as well, I think. In fact, my second son has become a level one teacher, and so he's teaching now as well. So we're beginning to have more and more of a yogic household here in Yorkshire. As well as doing teaching Kundalini Yoga, I'm also a Gestalt psychotherapist. So I'd like to bring some of the perspective of a psychotherapist to the topics today that we're going to discuss. Thank you. Satnam.
Satnam. Thank you all. I'm Guru Fateh Singh. Year-wise, I came to Kundalini Yoga in 1972. I first met Yogiji at Cornell University at an interfaith panel there, and life goes on. We wrote every month, and then he gave me the job to write a biography, and it's available. Still collecting stories. Anybody has stories? I'm listening. I heard some stories yesterday. I'm going to go in. So having a bit of an overview of Yogiji's life, having researched it and listened to so many lectures, not having as much one-on-one experience as Nam Kaur or Livtar Singh, who lived closer. I'm in Canada, but having, you know, had access to a really good archive here and met Yogiji a few times, you know, I have an overview from writing the biography of the things he did, which are many. We were saying yesterday that, you know, if you did a couple of those things, you'd be in Wikipedia, just two, you know, and he did dozens and dozens of really amazing things. And so I'm going to start going through the list, and I'm going to encourage my distinguished panelists to turn off your mute and give a holler if there's something you want to say about any of these things. We've got about 3 hours we can go to. So there's lots of time for anybody and everybody to make their contributions. We're going to start off with just some really sort of packaged things that are pretty much, you know, we take for granted. And we'll finish with some unfinished business, some projects that Yogiji gave us, some things we need to still work on. But the first one is obviously that Yogiji contributed to a global awareness of yoga. And I remember in 72 when I lived in our yoga center, I still remember that phone call. I tell my students about it. Somebody called and said, do we bring a spoon to class? Because there were great things coming from the East, you know. There was yoga and there was yogurt from Bulgaria. And so people got them mixed up, you know. So that recognition wasn't there that we just take for granted now. But back then it was a very mysterious phenomenon. And so no, don't bring a spoon, it's something a little different. They're both healthy, you can eat your yogurt, but not during yoga class. And you can study if you want to do research. You can study the progression, the growth in the popularity of yoga. It got a big boost. I mean, one of Yogiji's friends was Swami Satchidananda, and he had a couple of disciples, students who were doctors, medical doctors, and they did some serious research on the effects of a yogic lifestyle, vegetarian food, a meditation on particularly people with heart issues, right? Cardiovascular, we call it. And they published a paper, I think about 1990 or so. It was a scientific paper. This is science now. I mean, a lot of things we were doing as well. Yogiji said, tradition says, Guru Granth Sahib says, but doesn't carry weight really in our Western critical culture. So now we had actually a scientific study with data, and who picked up on it? The insurance companies picked up on the US. And they said, you know, if you actually do this program, we're going to cut your premium that you have to pay us, which was huge. So there was a big upswing in credibility and understanding of the importance and the significance of how what yoga can do for you just at that time. And after that, it really started to take on, started to take up. And I remember in the early 90s, my God, so few yoga classes. From the 70s, we were just hanging on, you know, with odd yoga classes here. We'd have an ashram with a few people, and not everybody would have a yoga class to teach because not everybody wanted to learn yoga. And so that was a big uptake in yoga when it built that scientific credibility in the insurance companies. Started to buy into it. And then yoga really started to take off. Even interestingly, I mean, I've been in India and I've been tempted to stay, but I know that East follows West these days. You know, I mean, we love our Eastern philosophy, but people in India and China and a lot of places, they're very attuned to the trends, what's going on in the West. And America is the trendsetter. And so it's interesting, once America and West started to pick up on yoga, now it's also become a big thing in India. Again, there's a Swami Rama, who's a big star in India and has been for a few years now. But that wasn't possible until Indians started to rediscover their tradition, saying, wow, those people are looking at our tradition. They're valuing it. And we think they're so cool. You know, there must be something to it. So that's huge. And it's, you know, it's an amazing time to live in, to go from a time when something that you value, most people didn't know how to spell it, till it becomes so mainstream. It's part of what being a pioneer is. You're out there and you're doing what you love. People don't know what the heck you're about, but you just stick with it. That's what pioneers do. And so we all, and Nam Prakash, you're a pioneer too. You know, even in the time since you started to now, yoga is still gaining, you know, credibility. There's still people don't want to do yoga.
Well, particularly in the area I live, I live in a little rural market town, sort of. Well, I actually live in a village 5 miles away from the nearest market town, and Yorkshire people are, I would say, mostly still back in the 1950s in terms of the culture around here. Certainly within my family culture, it was like that, you know. 10 years down the line from having indeed pulled my name change, I still maybe have 1% of people around me calling me by my Sikh name now.
Well, you got the 1%.
Which is great progress.
Waheguru. And we have pioneers. I think we still, I'm not sure, but maybe we've got Juma on the webinar. He was with us the last couple of days. You know, he's in Rwanda and Burundi. And my God, you know, definitely there, that's a frontier. That's a frontier. We got somebody was participating yesterday from, I think it was Mauritania. I mean, there are places out there where people are still getting it. And some people say it's very big in China, but that is a big country. You know, I think it's big in some parts of China, but certainly not everywhere. So, and we're a part of that. So Yogiji, he was a Sikh, and he inhabited this unique domain between Sikh Dharma, which he's a very avid Sikh, very inspired Sikh, and of Kundalini Yoga, very accomplished yogi. So he was inhabiting that space there, and in doing so, he also raised the profile of Sikh Dharma. I mean, he helped it to gain recognition, world recognition. I mean, there are still groups, Jains, if you've heard of the Jains, you can Google it, J-A-I-N. There's maybe about 10 million of them. There are the folks, we call them Farsis, or also known as Zoroastrians, another small minority. And they pretty much intermarry and just keep within themselves. And Sikhs were not that different, you know, when Yogiji came to the West. Sikhs kept to themselves, kept their head down, didn't bother anybody. We don't proselytize, you know. But Yogiji gave Sikh Dharma a profile. He came out there. He went out and, you know, when he had just a very few followers, he went and sought out the Pope. He went to Rome. He went to see number one. And he introduced himself. And that was, you know, that. And I met him at the Cornell University Interfaith Forum. You know, he became the face of Sikh Dharma. And the fact that he could actually convey Guru Nanak's essential teachings to non-Punjabis really struck a chord. People started to sit up and take notice, both within the Sikh fold and certainly outside of the Sikh fold. And so that was huge. He made a huge contribution. I'm going to come back to the different aspects of that. Yoga therapy is another area. I mean, yoga is yoga, but many people do it for the personal benefits, the health benefits. People didn't know about that. People thought, you know, yoga is this thing people do in the forest. They tie themselves in the knots, but what's the therapeutic benefit? Well, now we have people, I have a colleague, I like to plug her whenever I can, Dr. Jindani here, who did a study on Kundalini Yoga with post-traumatic stress disorder. We have David Chanahoff Kals, who has done a number of studies. He's appeared at the American Psychiatric Association conventions. We have Dr. Sapir Singh Kals at Harvard now. So these studies are starting to come out, and there's validity. You know, what is it? There's an association, the Association of Yoga Therapists, I think. I think Sapir is on the board. I mean, these are all light years removed from 1968 when Yogi Bhajan arrived. So much progress, so much understanding in the West. In India, people knew, you know, you do this Kriya, you do that Pranayama. Some people knew that, but not here. Not here, not in York, not in Toronto, not in Trinidad, not in Sacramento. You know, it's a big shift, it's a big shift. And what that did also for the Sikhs, you know, the cultural Sikhs, the people who were born into a Sikh family, it made them, you know, question themselves. They started to look at the world differently rather than just keeping their head down. They said, wow, you know, we're a global religion. You know, we have brothers and sisters who have different colors of skin and speak different languages. And a lot of them can't even speak Punjabi. And still, you know, they read from the Guru Granth Sahib as best they can. And so it made them made them question their own roots. Even Yogiji said that we made him question, you know, what it is to be a Sikh. And he learned from us how to teach Sikh Dharma, how to teach what I call Guru Sikh Yoga. In fact, that's not a term of my own. It's by Guru Das, who was lived in the time of Guru Arjan. He called it Guru Sikh Yogi. That's where somebody practices this yoga, chants Vaheguru, gets up early morning, keeps their hair, a holistic rather than escapist yogi, rather than ascetic. So it made people, Sikhs, to question, what is this, you know? And we helped them out a little bit. You know, it was still a small minority when I came here, came to this in Toronto. And, we did human rights cases. You know, we challenged the authorities. And I remember there's a fellow, Ishir Singh, who was working as a security guard. And they said, no, you can't work as a security guard with a turban on. He did a human rights case. He took me to court. And I did a couple myself. And I was happy to do that. You know, I heard in the States, I was reading the Beads of Truth, our magazine, that there are a couple of guys who were in the Army. And they would have a weekend leave. And there was one guy in the Navy and one guy in Germany in the Army. And they would take Kundalini yoga class. And they said, wow, we're so high. We want to be Sikhs now. We want to keep our hair. And of course, they go back to the army base. And they say, no, 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 no. And they forcibly cut their hair. And so they got a hold of, you know, Yogiji. And he sent telegram to the SGPC in Amritsar. And he needed to get a telegram. Because people, nobody in the West understood. They didn't know who the SGPC was even. And so just stating that indeed Sikhs do keep their hair. And it's a legitimate religion. And so Yogiji took that and got them their rights. So they were the first Sikhs in the American Armed Forces. And hearing about that, I said, well, I mean, actually, the head of my ashram, he challenged me one day. He said, you know, so-and-so was the planner, was behind, no, he was our contractor. He says, we had a big job renovating our ashram. Some of you have been in Toronto, you may have seen it. It's a beautiful place. About 77, we did that. He said, well, you know, Ram Singh is a contractor. He did a great thing, memorable thing. What can you do? So I thought, and I said, well, let's try this army thing. And so I did, and I applied to join the Royal Scottish Regiment, I think it was, here in Toronto. And they said, you can't join this, you know, because you've got a beard and you've got a turban. And so I said, no problem. So I applied. And there were no human rights commissions. We're just a little ahead of that curve. But I wrote the prime minister, and I wrote our, we have a kind of a socialist party here. I wrote the member of that party. And poor guy, the NDP guy said, how much we can do? You know, the rules are the rules. Got a nice letter back from the Minister of Defense. The secretary of the prime minister wrote that. But within a few months, they actually started a human rights commission. And I was one of the first cases. And I wasn't able to see it through because I was also just starting university as a mature student. I dropped out after grade 10, but I was starting university again. And so I was too busy. But I passed it on to somebody in my community, Akunkar Singh, and he carried it through. And my gosh, on Baisakhi, a couple of years later, the local MP brought a turban, you know, for the big Baisakhi Mela, brought it to the Gurdwara and gave the guy a turban. And so we were in. We were in. And now, and I don't know if you know this, but in Toronto, the Minister of Defense in Canada is a Sikh with a turban. You know, so I feel very humbled. We're just in the right place at the right time. It's just luck. But we've changed the world. We really have changed the world. And some places are a little further removed. In Canada, too, we have some places. I've been in Regina. You know, Regina is kind of like York. You know, it's way, a little still in the 50s. But, you know, slowly the populace, everybody starts to follow the trends in the urban centers. And so that's huge. You know, it affected us. We didn't know how to spell Sikh. And it affected the Sikhs at that time too. Some didn't like us very much because they, you know, Yogiji was pointing us out and saying to them, look, if those guys can keep their turbans, what's the matter with you? You know, you've been wearing turbans for generations. Some of them really disliked us about that. But mostly they were a little shy, but mostly they were very welcoming and appreciated what we're doing. And many times we ended up teaching their children, teaching them, we are the Khalsa, mighty, mighty Khalsa. Everywhere, and they loved it. You know, the children loved it, and the parents loved it. I even did I was invited once to do a whole program for Sikh youngsters. And at the high point, we had about almost 300 youngsters coming. And, you know, there were grandparents couldn't speak a word of English. But even though our medium was English, the grandparents were making it known that they appreciated you were passing that tradition on to their children. And so it's huge because they knew that, you know, this is a wasteland, really, you know. It's so easy to get sucked into McDonald's and, you know, all the MTV and all the distractions and totally lose your tradition. And so there's things we haven't figured out. Most of us are pretty mute, you know, but we can't speak Punjabi for the life of us. But still, you know, there are some things that we can contribute. And certainly they, I mean, if you want to learn about hospitality, go visit a Punjabi household and they'll show you a thing or two. Ma'am Prakash, would something to say?
Yeah, can I? I just wanted to jump in with a story that of my son and I visiting the Notting Hill Festival in London a couple of years ago.
What's a Notting Hill Festival?
The Notting Hill Festival is a big carnival. It's particularly in West London, in an area that's particularly people of colour. A lot of Punjabi people living in that area, a lot of black people living in that area, and they come out and they have their floats with the all their streamers and different aspects of their culture, singing, bands and dancing and this sort of thing. Everyone from London turns up into these few little streets around just near Kensington. So you might have heard of the Grenfell Tower fire that was.
Oh yeah, yeah. Mm.
Grenfell is right in the heart of Notting Hill. Mm. So that's the area I'm talking about.
It's public housing. There's a big fire in public housing. Uh-huh, high rise.
Yeah, that's right. High rise building that wasn't suitable for purpose. The fire cladding was insufficient. So this is it's right next door to Kensington, which is very wealthy area. You've got Harrods and all these sort of stores there, and then there's Notting Hill just round the corner, and it's like going into another world, similar to going from the Golden Temple where they've done all the courtyard at Amritsar, and then you walk into the back streets and it's like going into a different area. And so I had my heart set on visiting my son in London and going to the Notting Hill Carnival, and he was saying, "Mum, no, you really don't want to go, you know." Not the place for you. Anywhere is the place for me. Come on, let's go. And so my two sons, my son's girlfriend and I ended up walking through these streets. And I did realize what they were saying straight away. Very heavy drinking, you know, very lots of very lewd behavior. You know, the dancing after a few hours turns to more like strip joint kind of. So we were walking through all of this, the drugs taking, there were files of different things lying on the floor, you know, empty capsules of, and dressed in Banner and our turbans on, totally sober, chanting Satnam silently. Satnam, 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 where are we? But we had several groups of young Sikh men in particular throw themselves at us in tears, saying that we had... they felt such shame about their drinking, they felt shame about wearing the turban and drinking. And I was saying that, you know, we are actually very gifted here because we have chosen this. We weren't made to do it from birth. We weren't given it as a we should do this. We've chosen it, and therefore it's easier for us. You know, so you guys, you have to kind of be able to reject it in order to accept it for yourselves. But it was a very, very powerful, particularly for my son. He was 19 at the time. And so a lot of the young men his age, the Punjabi Sikhs, who were really affected by seeing him and the way he was really keeping up, you know.
Waheguru. Waheguru. Yeah, there's so many... connections, you know. I'll just build on that a bit, because Yogiji encouraged that, encouraged us. I think 75 was the last time he really encouraged us to learn Punjabi. His wife even put together a primer for learning Punjabi. But he you know, he didn't want to beat a dead horse, so he was going to keep pushing that. But that, you know, it's a matter of record. And I see that over and over, you know, the linkage. I told the story, I think, on Friday. I'll tell you another story. I'm working, typically I teach for the city of Toronto. There are classes through the Department of Parks and Recreation, very affordable. So I teach through there, but all those classes are shut. So I've been redeployed working in a homeless shelter for men. And so that's what I've been doing the last few weeks. And this is my last week in one of the shelters. Actually, on one day, some interesting things happened from two different people. So there's no turbans there except for me. But there's quite a few, let's say out of 62, maybe four or five of the men are registered. You recognize they have Punjabi names. They have Sikh names. And they're there without their hair and they're on hard times. One of the guys is really trying to turn himself around. He's working crazy shifts. He says, I'm not going to be in tonight. La, 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 la. But on the last time I saw him, he seemed kind of beside himself, a little stressed out, and came and went. And then he finally brought himself to speak with me. And you know what he did? Like, this is basically a homeless man working with him really hard. He gave me $100. And he said, please give this to your Gurdwara. Now, he didn't know. I tried to tell him that I didn't really go to Gurdwara as much. I've lived in Gurdwaras. But I tried to refuse, but I could see that wasn't the thing to do. So I, you know, I'll put it towards some publication, some worthy work. But my God, you know, the ordinary person doesn't give you $100 like that. That's, you know, he felt that connection, you know, and it's some shame, you know. And the other situation, one of the security guards was also a shaven Sikh, right? And he said he'd never seen anybody like me before. And I, you know, told my website and spending time on the website and. You know, again, he was just overcome, you know, how come? Because he's, you know, people get into this mode, this inferiority mode, that they've got this minority religion, nobody cares about it, they should westernize and pick up Western values and forget about Punjabi. And I was speaking to him in Punjabi, which really got him going. And so, yeah, we have a connection there. In fact, you know, during this COVID crisis, I've received two phone calls from students of mine offering me financial help to carry me through the crisis because they knew there were no classes. And you know, they're both Punjabis, right? Yeah. In fact, one is a Hindu married to a Sikh woman, whatever. They're students of mine, right? They're families of students of mine. And so I'm just telling you, I mean, by not tapping into the Punjabi community in a selfless way, I'm not saying doing it for self-interest because all the money they have, no. But if you can do it in a humble way, and please learn a few words of Punjabi, doors will open. You didn't even know there were doors there. So I think our potential is hugely, hugely inhibited by what I call our subtle racism, the boundaries we draw around ourselves. We don't have any idea what our potential is. And Yogiti wasn't going to beat us over the head about it. But that's part of the picture too. And I think part of it that blows a lot of people's minds, East and West, is that we define, as Guru Gobind Singh defined, Sikh Dharma, not as this package of rituals and you must. Because it's funny, because this children from the Punjabi families, if they want to rebel, they get their hair cut. You know, people like Aftab, I don't know, like myself, certainly, you know, when I was growing my hair, I was in trouble because, you know, they wanted me to look respectable. So we're defining it not by as a system of conformity, heaven help us, you know, but as a system of being very original, being in ourself, being our satnam, being authentic, and you know, and as a lifestyle. And if you're not doing it, as Guru Gobind Singh said, you know, "Ret pyare mujhko, sikh pyare nahi." You know, I love people's sadhana. I love people their discipline. I love when they're doing discipline when it's easy not to be doing discipline. That's what I love. I don't care. They just call me their teacher, their guru, and they say they're my Sikh. I don't care. That doesn't count for anything. So, and that's our routine. We're not about ritual. We're not, all right, we're not even about the culture, really. Though we like sag, you know, mucky roti and sag and all that stuff. But, we're really, you know, we're about discipline. We're about the science. That's what we're about. New kind of Sikh. Then another part of Yogiji's legacy is, you know, the countless people. Vipar was telling yesterday, I don't know if you heard his tale, but, you know, I'll just share it for those of you who didn't hear it. So they were coming, with Siri Singh Saab and his secretary were coming from the Caribbean to winter solstice in Orlando. And along the way, they stopped in the airport in Miami. And Yogiji just sat down somewhere, and people started to come to him. You know, some people maybe recognized him, some people just curious. And he held court there. And every hour there's going to be a plane. And so staff would say, Vipra would say, well, there's another plane at 4. We can just catch that plane. And Yogiji would just wave him off. There's another plane that's coming. If we can catch the 5 o'clock plane, wave him off. 6 o'clock plane. You know, he was there till the last plane at 11 o'clock, just holding court. You know, all healing people's hearts. And, you know, Yogiji counseled countless people. And so that's part of the legacy too. And some people may not remember his name, but he's touched so many hearts. Namkar?
That's what I saw him do wherever he was. Whether he was in the hospital, then he would be turning the nurses and the doctors into his patients. Whether he was on an airplane, he would be teaching the person next to him, oh, you have a headache, here's what to do. Everywhere he went, he was teaching, he was inspiring, and he was tuning into what the people around him needed. It was such a gift to watch. And it was also amazing to see how different he was with each student. Some people he would be very sweet and smiling to. Some people he would be a little more professional or business-like with. Some people he might yell at to get his message through. Some people he would feed to in order to make them feel cozy. And he just had such a way about him of seeing into each person's soul, but understanding the psyche of that person and how he needed to address them to get through to their soul. It was really amazing to see.
Why good. And he set us a standard to be 10 times greater than him. I mean, that's quite a standard. Liptar Singh mentioned how, you know, they were in the Caribbean, and typical routine is you get in your hotel and you cocoon and you make yourself comfortable. They would barely drop their luggage, and he would be looking for people that needed him. He was just looking for trouble, really, looking for challenges, looking for places where he can expend his gift, his energy. And right. That was what he did.
I, 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 yeah, um,
You mentioned Miami, and Liftar mentioned some of the things in Trinidad yesterday. And you know, when I met Yogiji and I wanted him to come to Trinidad, and I met him at Solstice, and I said, "So, I would like you to come to Trinidad and teach." And he said to me, "Sure, you know, get 100 students together, and I'll be there." At that time, I had like maybe 12 students. But I remember him saying, could be talking about his global influence. I remember him saying that people were saying he was sick, and the doctors were saying he shouldn't travel, he shouldn't go to these places because the traveling was making him more and more sick. And they said, "Well, why do you keep doing it? You're sick." And the doctors say you shouldn't do it. And he said, "You know, I have to go because they cannot come to me." So he had to go to these places and teach. So he came to Trinidad eventually, and it was the best experience I had. And I felt very honored to have him. And if I were to think in my life, what is the greatest achievement spiritually I've done, is I would say is having him come to Trinidad and to meet these students. We had like maybe a couple hundred students at the time when he came. And he demonstrated to me and to the students how humble he can be. I mean, we took him to meet the president, to the mayor, and the MPs and stuff like that. And he's used to that. Like you said, he met the Pope, he would meet presidents in different countries. But he also met people who didn't know him at all. People who he would just meet once. Like Namka is saying, he would meet people who he would just touch, and he would just relate to them for a short time and give them something. And I remember once we went to this place, it's called the Gandhi Ashram, which is supposed to be like the highest ashram in Trinidad, the Hindu ashram, where all the elite Hindu people go to, and the associate. It's like a club. It's a big Hindu club, you know. So he went there, he spoke there for a while. And it was pretty late at night. It was like maybe 11 o'clock when he finished. And then the president said, "Would you like to come to the house and have something to eat? Because you have all these dignitaries there waiting to meet you." And so he went there and he stayed for a while, about half an hour. He ate some things or whatever. I wasn't in the room because I was in charge of the security and driving. And when he was leaving there late at night, there was a group of people around the car. And I didn't know who they were. And I'm concerned because at that time, there was some tension with the Sikhs in India and the Hindus. And I'm a little bit suspicious of these guys. And he came out and he said, "What are these guys? Who are these guys? What do they want?" And I said, "So they're, don't worry about them. They're just guys. They want you to come to their place. I don't know who they are. I don't know where they're from. I don't know what their agenda is. I don't know anything about them. And it's not on the schedule, so I don't think we should go." He says, chalo, let's go. You know? So we went. And we went to this place, and these guys were driving really fast in bumpy roads, potholes in the backward area, which I've never been to. And I'm kind of a little scared because I'm thinking, well, I'll hate for something to happen to him while I am there, right? And he goes to this house, and everybody's chanting. I'm not sure if you know what a daltak is. It's a long piece of metal, which the Indians beat. And they go to this house. It's a mud house, and it's just a really simple, humble place. And he sits on the ground in the mud house, which is usually made of cow dung and mud mixed together. It's a little thing. And all they have is this dantal, this thing, this metal thing, and a dolok, a drum. They don't have any harmoniums, no sitars, no nothing. But they're chanting so vigorously, jai, 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 something or the other, you know. And he sat and he listened to them for a while. They did some RT for him. You know, they give this little dish that they have with flowers and things. And he cried.
And later on, he said, in my life, I don't cry much. And these guys, they touched my heart so much that I cried. You know, he said, I cried when my mother died. I cried when Carl Tuckett had this problem. And this is another time he cried. But it showed me that we don't understand a lot of things about how he teaches and the way it goes. So he would go to the most remote place, place which I would consider insecure, and not knowing anyone at all, not knowing what the people's agendas are. And he would go there, and he'd also go to the palaces, and he'd also go to the president's house. And he would go to every country because he knew that he had to go to these places to teach people. And this is just like one of the amazing stories and amazing experiences I had with him. I have lots and lots of stories I can tell you just about Trinidad, but this is one to really touch my heart and to see how humble he can be in his teaching.
My Guru. You shared that with a few other stories. Did you want to say some more?
But I don't want to keep up the whole day with this stories. I mean, I can talk on stories for the whole day, you know. I'm sure we all do. We all have lots and lots of stories.
Okay, that's good for now. That's good for now. Thank you. I mean, that story you did tell me, and I did stick it in the book, and a few other stories. So they're in the biography. But right. If we have time, we'll come back. All right.
Sure.
Namkar too. Namkar has a bunch of stories. I can see.
I'm sure. Yeah. We've been there for a while, so we probably have a lot of stories we can tell.
I'd like to add another way in which he is so genuinely thought of everyone and thought of our generations and the future of our planet. And that was the way he handled white tantric yoga, because he told us there could only be one Mahan tantric on the planet at a time, and that the mantle was passed. When the Mahan tantric died, it would pass to the next Mahan tantric. And so after he had a serious heart problem, and he started recording the tantric courses, and they were taught on video, he was still able to lead the tantric with his subtle body. The facilitator would be there, but he was still leading the tantric courses through the video. And my husband was his physician for the last 8 years or so of his life. And he said that when there was a tantric weekend, a day or two before the tantric started, he would see Yogiji's health go down. His vital signs would change. There was a noticeable difference in how he had to put forth that tantric energy, and it would affect his health adversely. And then it would continue for a couple of days after the tantric, which meant that there was only a window of a few days in the middle of the week where he could regain his health and regain his energy before the next tantric course started, because he taught them almost every weekend for a good part of the year. And when his health was really declining in the last few years, a lot of his staff and family were very concerned. And there were a couple of times where they asked him to stop doing the tantric so he could extend his life and be with us longer. And each time they did, he adamantly refused to stop. Didn't really give an explanation, but was just adamant that he was going to carry on teaching tantric. And of course, my husband was also very concerned, being his doctor. And we were discussing it one day when I realized he isn't going to stop teaching these tantrics. He needs to keep teaching them until he dies, so his subtle body can continue. And that's exactly what he did. He set it up that way with the recordings so they could still be taught now for all of us and for new students. And he could still be directing that, because he told us that once he passed, he could do more for us spiritually than he could in his physical body. And I think one of the big ways he does that for us is through continuing the white tantric. The other way he does it is coming to you in a dream. And a lot of new students have told me that they've had dreams with him, which makes me really happy because I used to wonder, how will new people feel the same master's touch that we felt with him in physical form? You know, how will they have that same kind of experience and realize what it is to have a spiritual teacher, aside from having the Kundalini yoga, aside from having white tantric, just having an example of someone who is selfless and serviceful and masterful in so many realms. And so it's really exciting to me that he's continuing to meet and greet new students, whether it's in a meditation, touching them through the tantric, or going to them in a dream to give them his message. Satnam.
My Guru. So the work goes on. So one of the really important areas Yogiji touched, because he could see our deficiencies, he could see our needs. There's a whole gender that had specific needs, and I think somebody, my teacher in Toronto, Gurtejkar, used to call the biggest oppressed minority on the planet, which is womankind. And so he addressed that headlong. I mean, here we have one son of God. That's our basic religion here. One son of God, never married, and didn't have a dad really. And that's our role model. Whereas in India, every god has a goddess. And typically, if you want to get to the god, you go through the goddess. It's a very different kind of a routine. And in the Sikh prayer, we start off Pritam Bhagavati Simarika. You pray to basically to the goddess first off before you even touch Guru Nanak. And so he started what we call the Grace of God movement. You can read about it. I'm not going to explain the whole thing. But basically, the concept is that woman is our first teacher. Woman is our first love. Woman is vastly underappreciated and vastly undersupported. As a culture, we can find technical ways of not having women. We can figure out ways to make embryos in laboratories or in factories. We can have sex dolls that talk to us. We can have a lot of stuff. But I think all that stuff takes away from our humanity, all that stuff. And Yogiji could see the trajectory we're going towards. And he devoted a lot of time to womankind. He created the women's camp. So it was huge. It was some of the fundamental teachings he gave us for the idea of a 40-day. And I researched this. It's not so weird. It's not even an original idea that after a birth, a mother, it's really good for her, it's good for the child, it's good for everybody to stay at home and be looked after. Before industrialization, my impression is that's what just about everybody did. I've seen in Philippines they did it, in China, I've seen students from Poland, they told me they used to do it. In Africa, there's examples all over the place. This is what people did, rather than, in the US, I think you have for a long time, I don't know if it's changed, like 2 weeks maternity leave and then back to the factory, So Yogiji said, you're not meant for that. It's a very important thing, creating human beings. You'll be able to make computers, very expensive computers when you go back to the factory and that's your job, or you may make designs for skyscrapers, but creating a human being, that's something priceless. And you need to devote some time to that, for heaven's sake. So, he encouraged us in that. And when our son came, we hired a good friend. That's what we did. And moreover, he took, again, if you dig into it, this is not original, but if you dig into old Indian tradition, there are traditions of celebrating the arrival of a soul before the birth. And so he, retold that story and reincorporated that and brought it into our lifestyle to celebrate, the arrival of that soul and to celebrate the institution of motherhood rather than, the baby shower and it's all baby, baby, baby. Celebrate the mother, celebrate her dignity, her grace, her creativity, her consciousness, her higher consciousness, and celebrate the possible rebirth of the world through that mother's womb. He said, forget about I mean, women never got the Equal Rights Amendment in the States. Never happened. But he said, you know, no, not to worry. If you give birth to a Christ, some Messiah, everything will be better. Everything will be changed. And you have the power to do that. So that's a huge, huge mission. It's a huge, very ambitious undertaking that he did.
Yes, he also created the women's camps. And for 4 to 6 to 8 weeks every summer for many, many years, the women would leave and come to be with Yogi Bhajan and with each other in New Mexico and camp out. And he would teach us very, very strenuous yoga sets in the morning under a big top tent. And during the day, we'd have various classes on topics concerning women and Sikhism and yoga. And then at night, we'd come back after dinner and have a lecture meditation class with him. And the men felt very underappreciated because they had to stay home and work and send the women to camp. But I, you know, that, again, that was just part of how he turned the tide. He saw that women, as you say, were underappreciated in our culture and needed time to reflect and be women, find their strength, be in the company of other women, have their peanut hours, you know, all these things, and learn the teachings from the Oriental style of being a woman, the art of being a woman. And so he brought all that to us. And he tried to change the tide by having those camps. And at the same time, once we all started having children, there was the children's camp at Ram Dass Puri. So the moms, again, didn't have to you know, the responsibilities of motherhood during that 6 weeks. They could really focus on their own growth. So that was another wonderful tradition that he brought to us.
Waheguru. Yeah, and connected with that, so there's building women to be all they were born to be a Shakti, you know, to be an empowering force. And then there's the children. I mean, God, the lectures, the talks, the harangues he gave us for not bringing up children well. Because he really, you know, as a teacher of that caliber, you have great sensitivity for others' pain and their suffering. And he felt that in the women, but he also felt it in the children, even within our families, you know. And he, you know, he did his best to correct us and help us to bring up great souls to affirm them in their destiny, to affirm them in their spirituality, to affirm them in their sadhana. And of course, Miri Piri was partly for that. We'll come back to that later. We talked yesterday about Livtar Singh's, well, up top, go ahead.
No, I was just going on with Nam Kar here. He did teach a men's course too, Nam Kar. He didn't leave us out completely.
because 1 weekend, not 6 weeks.
Right, I know. We complained, you know, enough. He said, okay, we're going to give you guys just like a little weekend spit, you know, a little couple hours every weekend he spent with us. And he, I have all his books there. And it was very intense. It's very tightly packaged compared to the ladies, of course. But the information, if any man has not read that man-to-man series or listened to his tapes, you should. It's very, very useful for every man to study. And of course, the ladies camp, I have the first lectures from the first camp was pretty much intense like that too, and then he expanded as he went on. I've noticed in the other ladies' trainings in the other years, but he didn't quite completely leave us out.
No. In fact, he did weekend courses. I've been through a couple of them. I think there were about 6 or 7 that he did over time. But mostly the focus was on the women. He said, you know, if a man falls, so you lose a man. But if a woman falls, a whole generation goes. So he was very strategic in his where he put his energy. Livtar Singh told yesterday about his marriage. Actually, described, I think, 3, because he's just had his 49th anniversary. So, and his was totally arranged out of the blue by Yogiji, with help from his staff. He asked, you know, who's available? Who will be a good match? So he did that many times. Some people, like the Gurukus, came to Yogiji. They already were in a relationship, but he pressed them, you know, make a commitment to a marriage. And so he did lots, not only arranged marriages, he counseled, he did reconciliations, and God bless us, you know, he would say, you know, marriages for once, and then still some of his students, he would reluctantly grant a divorce, and some would be married, I think the record might be 5 or 6 times. But so definitely lots of marriage counseling and so on. Aftab, you're not on mute. Did you have something you wanted to say, or you just forgot to put the mute?
Okay, I suppose.
Okay. So I'm just running through a list here of legacy items. So another legacy that if you go online, libraryoftheteachings.com, so many lectures there, and so easy to access. And so we're very grateful to KRI and those who have funded KRI and those who worked, put those lectures there. That's a huge legacy for us and for future generations. If you haven't gone there, check it sometime. Somebody was telling me the other day they take hookums from there, you know, and take sort of random readings. And why not? You know, there's a lot of wisdom in it. Also, one of the legacies Yogiji gave us, I mean, look, 1968, Yogi Bhajan comes to Toronto. Toronto was a very Caucasian city back then. It was quite insular and a very different city than what it is today. Today, majority of people in Toronto are people of color, all different colors. And I think Yogiji helped make that possible, and all of us did, by making folks more open and more tolerant. And we blew a few people's minds along the way. Not only the Punjabi youth looking at the Nam Prakash Kaur and others of us, but the Caucasians looking and said, what the hell? Because, you know, people like myself and many others could have easily just got by, just blending with the woodwork, blending in the background. But instead, we chose to make ourselves visible minority. Typically, visible minority, hey, that's where all the abuse goes. You're a visibly a Jew, or you're visibly Chinese, or whatever it is. That wouldn't help you if your skin color is different. You can't do much with that. Skin whitener doesn't work so great. But, everybody would like to abuse the minorities. And here we were showing up, all full of ourselves, and just saying, well, bring it on. You want to abuse me for being a Sikh? Don't call me a Bin Laden, or you want to call me an Ayatollah, call me a Paki. I don't care. You know, I'm going to go back, do my sadhana, and regenerate myself, and I'll just renew. You know, you can't hurt me. And that changed our culture a lot. We're very lucky to live in a fairly liberal city with a fairly liberal media here in Toronto. But still, whether you're in Vancouver, which is more conservative, or Trinidad or whatever, I think that just blew a lot of people's minds. You know, your culture isn't necessarily, well, some people took extensions to that. Some would say even your gender isn't necessarily the one you're born into. You know, take it however you want to take it. But we, I think, blew a lot of people's minds and really opened up the culture in our own ways. So another legacy is Yogi Tea. My God, Yogi Tea, Yogi Tea. I mean, it's a big enterprise in Oregon and also in Europe. Employs a lot of people. Beautiful product, and I think they still have sayings of Yogi Ji on it. And we're so grateful. I mean, Yogi Tea is healing and it's a healthy beverage. There are a few variations of it. We're so grateful for Yogi Tea. And thankfully, we still have it. And we did have our crisis. We lost the Golden Temple Bakery, but we didn't lose the Yogi Tea Company. Chardi Kala Jatta, you know that group? They do that kirtan. I mean, it's the only Krishna. All right, you give her credit. Krishna Kaur is the first non-Punjabi to sing in the Harimandir Sahib. Somehow, you know, she, first non-Punjabi woman to sing. We had a couple of Jattas that sang there in the 79 and 80. And then there was a long, long break, but the Chardi Kala Jatta, they studied under a very accomplished Ragi, and they got really good. She did a couple of teachers, I met one of them. And when they were ready, the SCPC, the management in Amritsar said, go for it, you can sing. And they gave them an irregular, semi-regular spot in the schedule. And so that's I mean, Yogaji loved to hear those guys when they were granted, you know, a spot to sing in the Harimandir Sabha. That was before, you know, really modern technology. One of the youngsters, he's a son of Harimandir Jog, son of Gurbachan Singh, and he would think he would secretly bring in his phone, and so we'd have a connection. We'd go to Gurbachan Singh, and Gurbachan Singh would send the live feed to the Siddhi Singh Sabha. And he loved, because Yogaji was about, largely about building bridges, you know, building those cultural bridges, and see that the children of some of the students were singing in the Harimandir Sabha, despite all of their cultural and linguistic and other handicaps, that they actually got there. And people were listening to them and giving them such respect. It was a huge, huge thing. And they're still doing it. So that's a huge thing. Sikhnet.com, the biggest Sikh website. And they're getting a little bit more Punjabi too. I've been pushing Guruka saying, what's your kind of more Punjabi material? They're getting there. They just had a Punjabi children's story. But still, it's a huge resource. A lot of kirtan on it. You have apps and sort of very humbly. But that's it's a huge legacy item. Miri Piri Academy, after years of sending youngsters from the West to schools other people were running, finally, I think it was 97 that Miri Piri Academy was established outside of Amritsar. It's a very barren place at the beginning. We're very lucky. Deva Singh, I think his name is, from Florida, came and landscaped it. Today it's just lush and beautiful. I'll talk more about Miri Piri as a work in progress later, but really that is a legacy that Yogaji passed on to us before his passing physically. Peace and reconciliation in Punjab. Oh my God, you know, those of us who are older remember when the army attacked the Golden Temple. There were years of conflict. I mean, and Yogaji told us the background story. It's fascinating to hear because, you know, as Guru Nanak, you know, he was like kind of a very empowered hippie. You know, it was all peace and love, you know, peace and love and Nam. Nam means be yourself, be true to your infinite self, not your emotional self, but your be true to that three-year-old, that playful, universal, loving being, you know. And so Guru Nanak was like that, but eventually we learned the necessity of defending ourselves and defending others. And came a time where Sikhs developed a reputation, the Khalsa Sikhs, the warriors, the Sikh warriors, of being a thorn in the side of anybody who wanted to oppress Punjab or to oppress India. So Sikhs gave a hard time, the Khalsa gave a hard time to the Mughals, the Afghans who came in, you know, Baba Deep Singh stood up to them. You know, you can Google Baba Deep Singh if you don't know the story. When the British finally came, oh my God, the Namdaris gave them such grief. And then the SGPs, the people that formed the SGPC, they stood up. And they were, you know, Mahatma Gandhi didn't like Sikhs. He was a Hindu. He didn't understand Sikhs. He called Guru Gobind Singh a misguided patriot. But the people who were best at the nonviolent resistance, those were the Sikhs. Those were the Sikh war veterans who put aside their arms, took a vow of nonviolence before the Akal Takht, and they went out wherever they needed to go and got beat up or got shot. And they fought for the freedom of India in that way. So they're a 2% minority. They made a lot of promises by the majority Hindus. Even the Muslims in Pakistan said, well, if you join our side, we'll give you da 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 da. But the Sikhs ended up in the Hindu side, Hindu majority side. And there were these promises that were kept, unkept, I should say, made but not kept, like giving them their own province. They had to fight for that, giving them a reasonable share of the river waters. They were farmers, they needed that, giving a holy status like Rishikesh got for Amritsar. They were not given that. A lot of, you know, unbroken, unfulfilled promises. And so by the early 80s, people started to get impatient. And moreover, as Yogaji explained it, the KGB had, that means the secret service of the Soviet Union, had their eyes on Russia. And already India was in their orbit. The communist state in Bengal, communist state in the south, in Kerala. And they wanted the whole place communist. And they looked around, and they said, well, what's the problem here? And They realized, too, the Sikhs were in the way. The Sikhs were not going to go communist, and the Sikhs were very fearless about fighting or dying for freedom, dying for human rights. And so they got in with Indira Gandhi. I don't want to go the whole story with it, but Indira Gandhi bought into their theory. You've got to humble the Sikhs. You've got to beat the Sikhs down, and that's how she's going to get elected, and that's what the Russians, how they'll get, the Soviets, how they'll get dominance in India. And so, you know, the Sikhs were targeted, and there's some very clever media manipulation. There's some very clever politicking, dividing the Sikhs to rule them, to conquer them. And it ended up with, you know, a lot of innocent people being killed. There was a civil war basically went on for years and years. And Yogi, through all of that, he knew people. You know, Indira Gandhi came to his yoga class, for heaven's sake, when he was teaching in New Delhi. And he knew the radicals. I mean, somebody was just telling me, you know, the talks from Sant Bindralwali, you know, the difference from the talks of Yogi, something like Sikh pride and living and keeping your hair and not taking booze. So there's a commonality there. But Yogi wanted to be in the middle, wanted to make peace. He knew Gyani Zail Singh, who was the vice president, or the president, I should say, of India. And difficult place to be, because when the situation is so polarized and you're in the middle, both sides are going to suspect you. And so to make a long story short, it was horrible. And a lot of people tried to convince Gyani Zail Singh, the president of India, to just quit, just pack it in, because there was so much atrocity done and he was not being kept in the loop about all those atrocities. And he persuaded Gyani, listen, please stay, because if you quit, people are going to say Sikhs, all Sikhs are anti-India. And if you think you've seen pogroms, massacres of Sikhs, you haven't seen anything yet. It's going to get so much worse. So he convinced Gyani Zail Singh to stay in his position. And he continued through the years to try and keep peace. Rumor is that Yogaji also funded some of the radicals who were trying to stand up against the Indian government. That's just a rumor, but you know, it's a very difficult place to be in. And finally, in 1995, he came to the World Sikh Conference. We talked yesterday about Luktar Singh's contribution there, sharing the song of the Khalsa. And Yogaji, you know, he said to Sikhs from everywhere, because the first world conference hadn't happened in many years, because the government would not allow Sikhs to come in numbers. But the situation had stabilized. They call it stabilized. Right? Basically, they massacred the militants in about 93. So, yeah, it was stabilized. And so Yogaji, you know, he said, spoke boastfully about, we've got to stay together. We've got to stay with Punjabis. That means Hindus and Muslims as well. We've got to have solidarity. It's in all our interests to do that. And so a very powerful, forceful force for peace, even though he was on a hit list, you know, even in Canada. I know there was a case in Montreal where they tried to kill him. You know, many times people tried to kill Yogiji for his stand. And so that's a huge, huge and very brave contribution he made. Another legacy item is all the Kundalini yoga teachers are. You know, people who studied under him, people who studied under people who studied under him. I mean, there's generations and generations and generations. And so I would guess there are tens of thousands of teachers in more than 100 countries. Namkar, you want to talk a little about that?
Sure, yeah. When I was living in LA, I wanted to just teach Kundalini yoga for a living. This is back in the early 90s. And I had managed to build up the number of classes I taught. I basically went to people in their workplaces or their homes and taught small groups and some private classes. And just as I had kind of gotten that to the point where, you know, it was not a full-time job, but doing well with it, I got a call from the Suri Singh Sab out of the blue one day. And he said to me, I'd like to ask you I'd like to ask you to volunteer at the secretariat 20 hours a week. The secretariat was where his staff worked. And my immediate thought was, oh no, I'll have to give up some of those classes. You know, I'll be too busy otherwise. And he said, and I don't want you to give up even one yoga class.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, yes, sir, okay. So I started working there, and I was working with Guru Amritkar, the Secretary General. And after a while, she said, you know, I don't really have that much for you to do. What do you want to do? And I said, I'd like to work for the teachers, because we need to find out what teachers in the field need. For example, every year we get these beautiful brochures for winter and summer solstice, but we get them like 2 months before the event. And people need to plan a year in advance and ask for time off from jobs when they're, you know, in a regular workplace. So we really need to find out from teachers what we can do better for them. And so that's kind of how we started, very grassroots, the International Kundalini Yoga Teachers Association. And at first I wanted to do a national association, because many countries in Europe and elsewhere already had national associations and we didn't have one. And she said, no, I think we need to be, we're international headquarters here. We need to be the umbrella for all the national associations, and we'll just roll the US into it. So that's how that came about. And after we kind of started going with it, and actually the Yogi G asked me to actually set it up as a membership at a certain point, create a membership for it. And he wanted it to coincide with the 25th anniversary of 3HO. So we did that in 1995 and formally launched ICTA, IKYTA. And he was very present in it with me from the beginning. He asked us to, I was working on a code of ethics, and I called him in Europe one day because there was a pressing question. I wanted to ask him about how to word something so it wouldn't go out in our newsletter and not come from him. It was, I don't even recall what it was, but it was something he needed to kind of sign off on. So I reached him in Germany by some miracle, and he just started, out of him just came the Solia Sapurin, everything that you see on that document, the 10 facets of a teacher. And we just worked on the very like black and white details of the code of ethics, but everything else he basically dictated over the phone that day, and I was writing as fast as I could to capture it all. And then we started to talk about teacher training, and even though that was KRI's province, he asked us to kind of sub, what's the word for that? Anyway, we did the work for that for KRI in a separate agreement. Subcontracted, I guess the word is. And so we started grandfathering teachers, and we started to form the new program for teacher trainers. And it was a very difficult process, because we had teacher trainings around the world that were so different. One person was training teachers in 2 weekends. Somewhere else in Europe, they were training them in a two-year program, a very thorough program. And somehow we had to bring together all these disparate trainings and opinions about what belonged in teacher training and make one international standard. And we worked on that for several years and went through several facilitators at our meetings. It was not an easy job. And at times I wanted to bang my head against the wall, because I wasn't a teacher trainer at the time. I didn't have a yoga center. All these other people did. They had been out in the field, grassroots, doing this in their various cities and countries for years. And yet we still had to come to some common ground. And so I would often go to him with questions. And finally he said to me, okay, get the outline from every teacher of what they teach, bring it to me. And so we had a stack. I mean, as I said, these programs were so different and there were so many. And he said, I want you to teach a 3-level program, you know, practitioner, instructor, teacher, and it should embody the best of everyone. But he didn't give specifics. So again, it was really a challenge. And at one point, I had been told that on many boards, the people who were on the boards would either give donations themselves or be responsible to raise a certain amount of funds for that particular nonprofit. And, you know, as a very small nonprofit, totally self-funded, no funding from any other area, we needed to raise more funds. And this was one of the things I was going to bring up at the next board meeting. I knew it would be controversial, but I thought it was important. And I was working on it very early in the morning in my office before the meeting. And he somehow tuned into that, called me at the office and said, "I know what you want to do. Don't do it. It's too much. We've already asked these people to sacrifice, and they've sacrificed a lot over the years building their own communities. We can't ask them to build this. We will find another way. And I expect you to make profit." And I said, "But it's a nonprofit." He laughed and laughed and just said, "That doesn't mean that it can't make a profit." And so we started to put our heads together, the few of us who worked, you know, at this point for IKYTA, and came up with some products to raise money. And we started the first teachers conference, annual teachers conference. And he came and spoke at that. And again, I made a big mistake, but he covered for me so graciously. I didn't have a lot of pre-registration, so I didn't have a lot of money to get like this big fancy room in a Santa Fe hotel. So I ended up renting a basement in a hotel, and it was hot and stuffy, and about 70 people showed up. We had a good day working on our agenda. I asked them to bring in fans for when he came and spoke so he would be comfortable, because I knew that hot weather just didn't jive with his body type. And so we did our best, but I sweated through the whole thing thinking, I made so many mistakes. I don't have flowers here for him. They usually do that when they have a stage. I've got this hot, stuffy room. Why didn't I plan this better? And I was really miserable. I don't even remember listening to his talk, because I was just counting all the ways that I had made mistakes and what I had to do better. And he so graciously, the next morning, I was doing some kind of save in the kitchen. He came into the kitchen and he said to me, "Namkar, your conference was a big success." And I thought, God bless him. I mean, to give me any credit for it was silly, and to not complain about any of the things that could have been better was just so sweet of him. And he was always very sweet and encouraging and one-on-one like that with me during the whole process of forming IKYTA and all the people who didn't like what we were doing on some level. I mean, I just assumed that everyone, every teacher around the world wanted to know what he said about everything, and particularly in terms of teaching and Kundalini yoga. But I quickly found out that wasn't always the case. And a lot of people had been doing it their way for many years without any interference from headquarters. So, you know, I kind of became like a target for a while, and they called me like a policewoman, and like I was spying on them, which was not the case. I was pretty innocently just trying to unite everyone. So it was a challenge. And he gave me a lot of personal coaching and that kind of praise, you know, to really keep my spirits up and to keep going with it. And I had never really been coached on anything in my life. I wasn't into sports. I didn't have any particular musical talent. So it was the first time for me that I felt coached, supported by someone to reach a goal. And it was a really new experience for me that I really valued. And the other thing he did that was so adorable, in the very beginning, he sent me a volunteer, a beautiful young lady, to work with me and help get IKYTA off the ground. And her father paid her salary, and she worked with me. And it was just such a huge help to have a partner and a sweet young woman. And then the second person he sent to me was a young man who he was in school in India. And then his parents got a divorce during the school year. So they both remarried and moved to other countries. And by the time this young man was going to be coming home to Española, he had no home. His home had been turned into an office, and he had no parents, no family to come home to. So, but he wanted to come home and be with all his friends. And so the Siri Singh Sabha assigned him to work with me and said, okay, you need to adopt him. He's kind of like an orphan at this point. Yes, he has parents, but they're not here. And I want you to feed him and work with him and teach him and train him. And again, it turned out to be it sounded like a job to me in the beginning, but it was such a gift to me. I didn't have any children, and it was a wonderful experience. And he had a very dry wit, a sense of humor, and he was just a joy to work with. So he always managed to do so much at once and take care of so many people at the same time. And I really value that way that he could heal. It was just something. And it was something I saw for 30 years in so many instances.
Hi, Guru. I'm thinking halfway is in about 7 minutes. Up top, you want to talk about how you were trained in Kundalini Yoga in Trinidad or wherever it might have been?
I'll go back a little bit to the history. I used to be an altar boy, and when I was 11 years old, I went to this library and I borrowed these books. And at the end of the book, it says, there are two kinds of yoga you should not practice. One is called a Kriya Yoga, and one is called Kundalini Yoga. And you need to have a competent guru to teach you this. And I did all the postures and it was easy. And I decided, well, I'm not going to do anything else, because if these are the two that's dangerous and it's so crucial, then why waste time with the others, right? So then later on in life, a longer story, I finally got to someone who was teaching Kundalini Yoga in New York. And in those days, we were all hippies wearing the Levi jackets, the long hair. I had decided to stop cutting my hair in February 1972 when I came to the States. I said, okay, that's the last time I'm cutting my hair in my life. I came up just to get a visa and they're coming up. So I came up and I met this guy and he said, just come to 146 Bergen Street and come to class. That's it. No big initiation or anything. And I went there and the yoga was fantastic. I felt great. I felt high. I felt super. I felt the Kundalini energy. And I decided I want to teach this to people in Trinidad, because there's nothing like this in my life I've experienced, and certainly nothing like this anywhere in the Caribbean. And I met a guy called Satnam Singh. He was from Tucson, Arizona. And he was one of the teacher trainers at the time. And I somehow got my way, similar to how Lifta did, by hitchhiking across country, and I got to Arizona. In those days, the teacher training was very different to how it is now. Now it's very streamlined, and thanks to people like Namka, et cetera, we have a set program going. In those days, you would teach, you would practice, you would do different things. And when you are ready, sort of, the teacher would take you to Yogiji and get his blessings. So that's what happened. After maybe a year or so, Satnam Singh took me to Los Angeles. I met with Yogiji, and he said, I asked for his blessings. And he said to me, Aftab, you are perfect in your knowledge. You're perfect with the teaching, but you have one problem. You know, the master's always going to find that spot, right? You know, that's the role of the teacher, is to find that weakness in the student. He said, but you have a weakness, and that's that one weakness, you have to cover that, and that's communication. He says, you know it all, but you cannot communicate it. You have to learn how to communicate it. So I've been working on communication all this time since then, 1973 to now. I'm still working on it. And Satnam Singh, and there's a guy called Gucharan Singh, who we knew from writing that Sadhana Manual, etc. He was in Pomona, so he was also another teacher trainer. And there were, I think, 3.5 teacher training ashrams at the time. One was in Washington, D.C., one was in Tucson, one was in Pomona, and one was sort of halfway in Phoenix, Babadon. He said, I should go to Guru Charan and I should learn how to communicate, because Guru Charan is an expert at communication. And then there was a little bit of back and forth, and it was found out that Guru Charan couldn't be teaching me because he's out of the country. So Yogiji said, okay, Satnam Ji, go and teach in Trinidad, and you will learn communication along the way. So I went to Trinidad and I started teaching. So it was very different. I became a teacher to how people are becoming teachers now. And strangely, the first job I got when I went to Trinidad was working in a radio station. And you know, and I got a job as a technical engineer, recording stuff and playing things on air and recording what they call programs for people. And I would do massage on my part-time. And I met this guy who would come to massage, and he said to me, what do you do, I mean, besides massage? And I said, well, I teach yoga. And he says, that's wonderful. He said, would you like to teach yoga on the radio? He said, it's never been done before. He said, he's been in Canada, he's been to the States and England, he never has seen yoga on the radio. And we got into talking about how we can teach yoga on the radio. And he was the head of the bank, the big bank in Trinidad. He had a lot of clout, a lot of power, political power. So he said, if you can get a package to me, I will get it on the radio for you. So he did that, and we got it on the radio. I had some really very good, beautiful students who Yogi Bhajan described as the most beautiful students he's seen in the world. It's from Trinidad. They were very devoted, very, dedicated. So he puts together a program with music and a jingle, and I started teaching yoga on the radio. But before I did that, I had to learn how to communicate. So I had to go to a speech therapist. I used to speak a lot worse than I'm speaking now. I used to speak very fast. My voice would trail at the end, you know, and things like that. So I had to get sort of like a nonce training. So that's how I started getting more students, if you want to call it, in Trinidad, from the yoga program that I started doing 3 times a week. So it was quite different from a lot of the path, I guess. My path is quite different to like how yours was and how most other people are. They started going out to someplace and teaching. They could talk pretty well and all that. And now it's a lot easier for teachers to become a teacher by attending the training. My preference is the style that Nam Ka started, the immersion. That when someone says they want to become a teacher, I say, okay, go and do the immersion course. And if you can't, go to New Mexico and do it, you know? Get the full thing. Because when you become a teacher, you want to experience. You want to experience the lifestyle. You want to experience the sadhana on a day, 24-hour basis. You want to go through that drill, you know? I train teachers now, not in Kundalini Yoga, as taught by Yogi Bhajan, but the certification program, 200-hour program, and we do it like on weekends, every other weekend for like, you know, 10 weekends. It's a quite different experience doing that. So living in an ashram, and or if you can, we don't have many ashrams anymore, but you can go and learn how to be a teacher in an immersion course. I think that's a great way, but it's quite different still from the way in which it was done long time. When I first started teaching, I had a lot of hostility. Just like how when Yogi Bhajan started teaching here, he met a lot of hostility in India. I met a lot of hostility in Trinidad. At one time, I was sort of accosted in the street by some religious fanatics, very Christian guys. And they got me into a room, and they would not let me out of the room until I would admit to them that I will not teach this yoga anymore, or I would accept their religion. And we went through this argument for a long time, very calmly, and we were there for like 5 hours. They wouldn't let me out of the room. They were like 6 guys, you know. And I eventually got out of the room by saying, I tell you what, you pray for me, and you pray for my soul, because maybe I'm a lost soul. Maybe I'm going the wrong way. It's possible. Or maybe you're going the wrong way. So I'll pray for you, you pray for me. And that's how I got out of that. But, you know, so in the early days, there was a lot of hostility, a lot of resistance to Kundalini Yoga. Now everyone is teaching Kundalini. You go everywhere in the world, everyone is Kundalini Yoga. Every little studio now is saying, yeah, Kundalini, we work with Kundalini energy. But in back in the 1970s and 80s, the word Kundalini was taboo. People didn't want to hear the word Kundalini Yoga. They associated it with all kinds of weird stuff. I remember having an interview with a TV station when I was trying to get Yogiji into Trinidad. And the first question the lady asked me, she says, isn't Kundalini Yoga so dangerous that you become insane and you get these snakes forming in your body? And these were the kinds of things you have to conquer and work with, you know? So it's very easy now for the younger generation to teach, because they can just go on out with sort of like the ice be broken for them. Mm-hmm. But in the early days, it was very tough, you know? So that's the kind of experiences I had in my early days. I'm not sure how it was with you, but similar to how Yogiji had that resistance in India, people were very much against him and they would even get violent or hostile. So that's my sharing on that.
Why, Guru? You're a real pioneer in Trinidad.
Well, yeah, I think I'm not sure how many of the old pioneers who went out of the United States are still around, but I was sent out to Trinidad in 1973. That's when he said, "Give me the blessings, just go teach there."
Right, and you can communicate now. You're doing pretty good.
Well, I'm working on it still. Yeah, I'm still trying to.
Can we take a break? What do you think?
Yeah, of course. Let's take
a break. We're going to take a little bit of a break. Thanks so much.
Okay.
I'm going to play some music. I don't know if it's going to work very well. Try and listen. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. Stretch your legs. Go bathroom.
The years went by, we learned how to fly. Feet on the ground, head high in the sky. Wake up in the morning, fall of the morning. We're comfortable, and we are healthy. Keep on going, happy.
Mm-hmm. Satnam, everybody. Maybe we'll wait a couple of minutes till more people come back. Okay, Aftab is back. Sound check, Aftab, you can hear me? Well, we can't hear you, of course.
Yes, I'm hearing you, yeah, fine.
Great, okay, good.
Yeah.
All right, so let's just start then. So we're talking about Kundalini Yoga teachers all over the world, the starting of the International Kundalini Yoga Teachers Association. Contribution, another legacy item is Yogi gave us an institution. I mean, he started off, God bless him, you know, he was entertainer, he was a wise man, he was a counselor, he was father, sometimes he was mother. He was so many things, healer to us. And he was very fortunate in that, I think we were all fortunate in that. I think it was 71, there's this young man, full of fire, he's 15 years old, he comes to Yogiji to learn. Actually, Yogiji goes to his high school and gives a talk. And this guy, kind of a upper class high school, they have more liberal arts subjects, he just loves Yogi Bhajan and what he taught. And so he started to come on a regular basis, started to come to sadhana, and just absorbing everything Yogiji had to teach. Yogiji said, you know, you guys should turn up at the Sikh study circle. There's no Gurdwara yet in Los Angeles, but the handful of Sikhs that were there, they had a study circle. They'd get together once a week and do kirtan. And so this guy, this 15-year-old, started to go and just soaking things up, learning yoga, coming for sadhana, hanging out with the Punjabis. And it really came to a crescendo, came to a high point when there were a group of Yogiji's students, mostly wives of his teachers, who went with his wife, Yogiji's wife, to India. And this fellow called Dale went together with them. And it was just so inspiring. They went to Amritsar, they went to, first they learned kirtan and they started to practice. You know, they started to practice kirtan, how to sing the songs of Guru Nanak, and then they went on a tour. They were like stars, because it was such a new thing to have folks from the West dressing in bana and not cutting their hair and not taking the alcohol and singing the Guru's words. And so they'd have thousands of people turn up, and it was huge. And it was also just very humbling for him. He was learning Punjabi, and he was practicing, sharing with people, learning more Punjabi in Punjab. And just a beautiful young man. When he came back, Yogi Bhajan gave him a job to take care of the Guru Granth Sahib, which was in Guru Ram Das Ashram, to be there every morning, to what's called Prakash, and to be there in the evening to close the thing down. And he had to come a few miles to do that. It wasn't easy for him. But he rode his bike and he didn't complain. And he inspired people. He learned Sikh history, started teaching Sikh history, learned how to pronounce, you know, the Japji, and then he started teaching it. I remember I took a class with him at a summer solstice. He was just this humble, humble young man. And so Yogiji gave him a job and gave him a title called the Bhai Sahib. The respectful title in the Sikh tradition means respected brother. And so he was there in Los Angeles. And I won't go into the whole long deal. He became basically a Sikh institution in himself, a great teacher, a great inspirer. When people wanted to take the Amrit ceremony, he would be there, help them to do that initiation. And didn't live very long, had a car crash 2 years later. But he had established the institution through his life of Bhai Sahib. And Yogiji had first, you know, put that together and given him the title. So we had two people with big titles. One was Siddhi Singh Sahib. Yogiji we called Siddhi Singh Sahib. but also we had a Vaisaya. And so that's huge. Yogaji created that. Someone else picked it up. Guru Lif Singh also picked it up, made a lot of contributions. And currently, BBG, who's our Vaisaheba, she carries that. It's a little hard. She's mostly in Los Angeles, but she also has published books and taught a lot of people, inspired a lot of people. So that's another contribution, legacy item from Yogiji. Yesterday, we talked a bit about the Temple of Steel. Yogiji had a vision that we have a golden temple at Amritsar. Why don't we have a Temple of Steel in the West? Yogiji would say he brought us from Woodstock, as hippies, to Steelstock. So we should have a Temple of Steel. One of his students in Paris, an architect by the name of Gurhan Singh, made a beautiful design. And Guru Singh from London sent me a very articulated piece on that, which we'll have to share, very detailed designs and backstories to that. A very beautiful vision that one day there will be a Temple of Steel at Ramdas Puri. We've been having our summer solstice. So that's also a legacy. And there's a Sikh Dharma ministry. I mentioned yesterday that up to that time, there wasn't such a formal ministry, wasn't an international ministry. In fact, it's kind of funny. You know, the British came to India and they had their missionaries trying to convert everybody. And of course, the Muslims before that, under the Mughals, they tried the same. Well, just to have kind of a revenge, you could say, the Sikhs, when they got control of Amritsar again from the British, they started their own missionary college. They called it Sikh Missionary College. But the honest truth is they didn't train missionaries. It was all for internal consumption. And it's been that case for many, many years. And it was all men also. But the ministry Yogiji started was men and women. And, you know, it was important to establish, again, Sikh Dharma to have a place in our Western culture. We have a foundation, we have an institution, we have a hierarchy and so forth. Though, you know, we're not so big on hierarchy, but it's just it's an institutional framework. One of the roles, one of the titles Yogiji gave under himself as Siddhi Singh Sabha was Mukhya Singh Sabha. Mukhya Singh Sabha, if you got the title Mukhya Singh Sabha, it was almost like a kiss of death. Because Yogiji would say, you know, I don't forget exactly how he put it, but when you become Mukhya Singh Sabha, then sometimes your ego starts to really take over. And I'm a Mukhya Singh Sabha. And next thing on, Siddhi Singh Sabha passes on, I'll be the Siddhi Singh Sabha. I'm the boss. And my God. You know, Liftar Singh and Krishna are a couple of Mukhya Singh Sabha, but they are the successful Mukhya Singh Sabha. They are so sweet. You know, there are people that I can email in the administration. They'll never email me back. But those folks, they're very responsive and sweet and kind and knowledgeable. Those are the role models that Yogiji wanted. So that's all part of the ministry. And Mukhya Singh that literally means or Mukhya Sardani Saiba, a spokesperson. So that's what he wanted. Not big shots, but just humble people. In fact, Yogiji said, you know, the way the institution works, if somebody made a pyramid once, and he says totally upside down. The way the pyramid works is upside down. The top is just everybody else, you know. And then you have the yoga teachers, you have the ministry, you have the Mukhya Singh Sabhas, and then I'm on the bottom. I serve everybody. That's how it works. And so that's the vision that he gave us of a ministry that serves everybody. And I mean, the more stories I hear of Yogiji at the airport or going to Trinidad, the way he served, heaven help us, you know. I mean, I'm still working on, you know, 10 times greater, but I just see, oh, that's a big target. I'll never give up, but it's a big target. So that, anybody want to talk about the ministry? Nobody. You know, my son, he says, you know, younger generation, nobody wants to join the ministry because it's all old fogies, basically. He didn't say it in those words, but ministry has some work to do. But, you know, it's still there. It still has a newsletter. And hopefully one day it can be perhaps a little more representative. And that's perhaps a good segue to the next section, because I'm going to talk now about unfinished items, business, things Yogiji gave us that he didn't finish, that we really have to finish and complete. And one of those interesting things, there's a story, I think it's a Finnish story really, but it's about the Unto Infinity group. And I don't know so much all the details about it. The yogi set up this board, called it Unto Infinity. I know they had some charity golf tournaments. I don't play golf. But basically the people there, whether Yogiji, probably he knew they were going to do this. He was pretty intuitive. But they basically tried to take over a lot of our organization. I don't even know how much of it. Some people, I'm sure, know this better than I. They ended up walking away with basically the Golden Temple Bakery and a lot of money. They had to be paid off. So it was interesting. You know, we got to, after Yogiji passed, I think about 3 years later, there were folks who said, well, Yogiji's not looking. Let's see what we can do. And even it penetrated, I think, to the very high levels of KRI, because we had the leader of KRI come to Toronto, and he was telling me, I told some of that story yesterday about how, you know, there's these smart people, they have a business vision of how things should be done. And I wasn't too impressed. And that head of KRI isn't with us as a head of KRI anymore. And the whole Unto Infinity, they were paid off. They're gone. And I'm grateful for that. So I'm just saying, he gave us some unfinished business, some house cleaning needed to be done. I think that chapter is finished. Another piece, and I spoke with BBJ, his wife, about this the other day. She said she's not bitter. She doesn't want this to be in the papers. It's not a big deal. So I'm not going to make it a big deal, but I do wish that the inheritance were settled satisfactorily, because that's just not nice that he makes a will and that the conditions of the will are not carried out. End of topic. Another item, and I mentioned it before, Miri Piri Academy. Some of you may know that it's in recess because of the COVID virus. There are people in the Sri Singh Sabha board who decided that it would be best not to convene school, not to have school in the coming year. And, in investigating, I found that, there are folks in the board who feel basically Miri Piri Academy bleeds money. And, it's Miri Piri Academy is a problem. And I feel Miri Piri Academy is vulnerable. And once you shut it down for a year, you need to make arguments. You're going to lose students over a year. And, maybe just dump the thing. But my view is that Miri Piri is really a fulfillment of much of Yogiji's thinking, creating an academy which is multicultural. I mean, a third of the students are Chinese, last I checked. Multicultural, it's in Punjab. You have opportunities of learning the Punjabi culture, learning the Punjabi language. Yoga is a part of the curriculum. Seriously, subs dictate those who graduate from Miri Piri Academy, they have a diploma to be able to teach Kundalini Yoga. It's a very beautiful, beautiful thing. My son studied there for a few years and worked there for a few years. From various sources that I have, I see that there's unfinished business. And I'll share with some ideas that I have, and I'm open to anybody's input, perhaps to somebody in the audience. I see some questions come up. We'll deal with those later. Thank you, Ram Dass Kaur. But I want to talk about Miri Piri Academy a little bit. One thing, this ties in with, there are some young people. We call them young people. Like, I'm 66, so young people, we call them their 40s. Young people, but there are folks, we call them second generation 3HO, who are very, very upset about different stuff. And they've had hearings. Some are upset about being abused in India. Some are upset about unfulfilled promises. And I was just in my research, I'm finding out that indeed, the people who went to school in India, they were told that, we have these family business here, Yogi Tea, Golden Temple Bakery, of course, security. And if you go to school in India, you'll come back and you can start at the bottom, but you'll work your way to the top. And the information I'm getting is that that's not happening. You can graduate from Miri Piri Academy. And there's basically, there's a whole area that needs to be covered, which is follow-up. Because Mary Pierre Academy is such a pristine, beautiful place. If you end up going back to Detroit or Hamburg or Moscow or Caracas or wherever you go, it's a big culture shock. But B, what the heck do you do with yourself? You know, so I'm suggesting to have less rage at the younger level. They really need to be served. You can't just plunk them into India and then plunk them back and expect everything is going to go great. It's not. They need guidance for education opportunities, where to go after Mary Pierre. You need career guidance. And if they're promised positions in companies, those promises need to be fulfilled. So there's a culture shock. There's follow-up. I mean, it's not just find a perfect school. It's not a perfect school. Even if it were a perfect school, you know, an idyllic place in Amritsar, and they expect everything is done. It's not. So there needs to be follow-up. It's also been suggested that there be a counselor. I mean, granted, it's difficult to get bullying out of anything. I was talking with Krishna Kaur the other day, and we're talking about bullying, and he said, you know, we get bullied every day. You know, the advertisers bully us. The politicians are bullying us. There's so much bullying that happens in family, outside family, in school, at work. But on campus, the children, the youngsters, should be protected to some extent, and would help them to have a counselor, someone who has an ear for them, someone who can give them guidance. Nanprakashka, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I would really like to speak to this issue of Mary Pierre and, as you mentioned, rage from the young people. And I'm not sure it's as simple as the bullying aspect of it that's coming up. As I didn't go to Mary Pierre, but I was sent away to boarding school. So I have my own experiences about that. And I've also visited Mary Pierre, so I'm familiar with the school itself. And it does look so beautiful there in, it's in Anamposaib, right? And it's in, it really does look lush. I know from my own experiences, when I was asked about boarding school initially, I would have said this was a really amazing gift that I was given. You know, it was a privilege. And, you know, it gave me opportunities in the workplace, these kind of promises that you were speaking to. What I became aware of as I started doing 6 years of psychotherapy for various kind of flashbacks coming up and similar things to what this second generation of young people are talking about now, is that the actual act of being sent away from those that you're attached to as a child is really extremely damaging to the psyche. And I think maybe the yoga can address some of this. Maybe not, I'm not sure. But what I see from people commenting now is this kind of deep split in the psyche from having to, you know, work out how you would be sent away from everybody that you love and people who are meant to care for you into an environment where at best somebody is looking after, you know, 10, 20, 30 other children. So I think it is something that really needs a lot of careful listening to people who've been there, because not everybody will have that experience. Some people will have really positive experiences, but some people will have been really damaged. I think there's really good evidence now coming out of something called boarding school syndrome that, you know, because these wounds can be healed as well, and we actually have the perfect technology for that. But of course, what we're in danger of happening is the very things that can help heal are going to be the things that are rejected because they're seen as coming as a package.
Mm-hmm. That's ironic. It's ironic, and you know, it's a funny thing. I mean, I'm a bridge builder kind of person. I don't shut people off. I don't cut people off. Yogaji didn't. So that's the example that I follow. And I emailed, you know, the lady who wrote that book that got published in January every once in a while. She helped me with writing a biography to a degree. There's certain questions nobody else could answer. So She was helpful. But I emailed her back. I read her book. And I emailed her at one point, and I said, partly from your experience, Nam Prakashkar, do you remember we talked about, you know, God bless her. She's such a warrior. She went to the, what they call it, the white bird and the golden cage Facebook group. She joined the group and was trying to do counseling there. And it was so insane, you know. But partly based on your experience, you want to say something?
Well, I learned very quickly that was a huge mistake on my part to try to do counseling on that group. I think you're absolutely right. I did start. It was very misguided to think that people would on that group would want fixing. You know, and so I was told that's really in very clear terms that was
that's how you learn
what was needed. I learned my lesson. What I did I really stayed put on that group for a long time because I felt like I wanted to speak to some kind of neutrality. You know, we talked a lot at the time, didn't we, Guru Fatasing, about the polarization of that was happening in the community.
So what I'm getting at is partly based on your experience. I wrote the author, you know, the author of that book, and I said, you know, hey, congratulations on your book. I know what it is to write stuff and try and get it published. Congratulations on that, and congratulations. I may have congratulated her on her, you know, she's achieved some degree of fame. You know, good for you. But I also cautioned her, you know, that. That what she's doing in that, she's triggering a lot of people, whether in or outside of 3HO, she's triggering a lot of people to experience trauma. And the question is, what do you do with that? I mean, it's difficult. I mean, I've done research on this. Who's his name? There's a fellow. Basically, the best research we have now that shows that talk therapy doesn't really help. Often it just reawakens the wounds. And one of the best things you can do is body-mind therapy. And Kundalini Yoga is very rigorous in this. So I said to her, you know, congratulations on all that, but you've got to know that by your work, you are barring that route of therapy, perhaps the best in the world, for people to find their Satnam, to find their intrinsic, healthy, happy, holy being. Because they don't want to do Kundalini Yoga, Sattva Yogi Bhajan. It's going to freak them out. So I said, you've got to be aware of that. She didn't like the comment. She emailed me back, said, you didn't read my book, did you? Well, of course I did. But she didn't like the comment. But it's true. It's a dilemma. Aftab Singh, you want to say something for more?
Well, we're all yogis. And we all were trained or have taken up some training with Yogiji. And we qualify ourselves to be teachers, and some of us are more equal than others in that way.
Can we just stay on the trauma topic? Were you going to change subject on this?
No. Getting to that. So what I'm saying is that as yogis, we need to see the positive and the negative in everything. So in Mary Perry, for example, the abuse there and the book that was published, it may seem to be very negative in some way, and it also is very positive. So we have to be able to see the value of the book too and the publication. Like how you said, it brought people out, for example, to talk more. The people in Mary Perry are probably talking out more. The idea of abuses that may have happened or not in Mary Perry or elsewhere. Getting those people to talk and to come out more is great. There's a little bit of an issue here in that they're talking to the older heads. And this is one part that maybe the organization might look at as far as resolving things, is that we, like me, for example, I should say, I'm an old head. I think in a certain kind of way. I've been trained in a certain kind of way. The things that I would consider abusive, or not abusive, would be considered very highly abusive now to people. The way that Yogiji talked to me, the way he yelled at me, could be considered very abusive now. But to me, I saw it as a spiritual practice, as a spiritual way, in his way of teaching. So people have developed certain what is called sensitivities now, and they relate to things differently. So I think the way that a lot of these things should be handled would be to allow the younger generation to handle this. The younger students, the younger teachers, the younger teacher trainers, people who are possibly under 30, 35, 40, who are under that age, let them resolve that because they will understand that better. We may have a generation gap. We mightn't want to admit it. We say, well, we are understanding, we are sensitive. But I think on all these kinds of abuses and people on the side of asking, why don't we talk about sexual abuse and sexual assault? These things should be talked about by people who can probably relate to it more at this stage of development. My way of approach to it would be quite different. Like I said, I could claim that Yogi Bhajan abused me, you know, based upon the standard that some people are using now. But I don't feel it that way. I don't feel he abused me. He yelled at me. He cursed me out. He chewed me out, you know. He caused me a lot of physical pain, personally. He also was very gentle and very touching. He very lightly touched me too. So I see the balance there, and my relationship with him is different to how these other people are. So we have to be sensitive to that, and that we can't have our old way, as our old standard sort of thing, address the younger people. Let the younger people work with that. Let them talk to each other. Let them find a way out of that. That's my comment on the abuse part.
You want to, Aftab Singh, you want to just tell briefly the story about your driving and he pinches your thigh? Tell that story.
I can tell you the two stories really. So I should come to them because, like I said, as a yogi, you need to.
No, just tell me one story. Tell the one on the pain story.
Okay, the pain story was. I was driving on the right-hand side because in Trinidad, you drive on the right side of the car. And we were going from the hotel to the mayor's office
or
something.
Your phone has no data connection, so I can't help you with that at the moment.
I'm not sure. Maybe that's my phone doing that. Let me just power it off. Yeah. So we were driving from the hotel to one of the someplace, because the president's house or something. And he put his hands on my thigh, on my leg. And now some people may say right away, oh, you put his hands on your thighs? That's sexual abuse. You know, he rested his hands on my leg. I didn't see his dad. And then he, looking through the window on the left side, he doesn't look at me, doesn't look at anything. He starts pinching me, really excruciatingly pinching me. And he knows he's doing it. He knows I know he's doing it. He's not acknowledging it, and I'm not acknowledging it either, right? And he continues pinching. And if you know Yogi Bhajan, he's very powerful. He's very strong. And my first impulse was, say stop. I could just say stop. I could just say, okay, I don't want you to do that. And then because of my relationship with him, I say, fine. He is my teacher. It's like Vaisakhi. When the gurus went and they had to give their heads, I said, okay, he's my teacher. Do whatever you like, you know? And in that excruciating moment, the minute I said that in my mind, he stopped. He knew somehow that I had gotten the message. I just let go. But it's a different kind of relationship. But if I did that to a student, now they'll put me in court. They'll say he abused me. He put his hands on my leg. Then also he created this extreme pain. He could have actually pinched off a piece of flesh from my thigh, and that would be abuse. So how do we judge that? How do we say spiritually this was abusive or not? It's the person who's receiving it. would determine that. I mean, I could have gotten angry and I could have reacted in some way like people are doing now. So each person is valid. Their complaints are valid based upon their own whatever template that they're running from. But the way to address this, I think, in a big way, and maybe the woman should get more involved with this than the men, because I would think the younger woman, people like Nam Prakash, for example, she should get more involved in forming that group. And people are angry. When people are angry, they don't hear. So people are venting on the websites and they're doing this whole thing on the Facebook. They're angry. And they should be angry because that's their experience. That's how they are programmed to be. Mm-hmm. They're not into this mode like I was programmed to be. So for me, I would say, hey, okay, so you hurt your leg. So what? Not a big deal. Pain is gone. Let it go, right? But other people may have a different way of approaching that.
Right, Guru. Thank you, Aftab Singh. That's a great story. You know, if you just, can you hang back a little bit? Because I know this is getting us going. Oh, I think everybody wants to speak. Let's just say, I want to spot the people of Miri Kiri. So this is a little side note on Miri Kiri. Let me finish with Miri Kiri, and then we'll go on. We'll get deeper into this a little later. And there's a couple of folks I think is very important. We want to talk about how to teach Kundalini Yoga in the current atmosphere, which is very challenging. We're not going to neglect that. So let's get to that as well. But let me finish with Miri Kiri Academy. So there's the issue, there needs to be follow-up for the students. It would be very helpful to have a counselor on staff for the students. If they're promised jobs, those promises should be kept. Also, I am advised that the staff could use more training. I mean, the way they say it is they survived by the grace of God. Nothing really, really horrible happened over that, but they could use training in dealing with students with suicidal thoughts, for example, self-harm, how to talk with students about sex, how to talk to them about sex education, racism, substance abuse, bullying. You know, how do you deal? Staff doesn't have much training in that. They had one little training about bullying. That was it. Professional development. I mean, generally teachers everywhere have professional development. It would be great to build their confidence and to build their knowledge of current best practices. And ideally, it wouldn't be just once every 5 years, it would be maybe a couple of times a year. Just a little refresher. And frankly, they could use more staff. I'm told that, you know, there would be staff meetings, but the staff would be falling asleep because there are hours when either you're actually working or you're on duty, as they say, or on call, would be from 5 a.m. to 11 p.m. 6 days a week. And if somebody is sick or somebody's away, then it's not six, it's 7 days a week. That's hard. Oh, 40 day sevas. They had 40 day sevas around the Golden Temple. Then your hours are longer too. They go beyond 5 to 11 at night. So more staff. I understand it costs money, and the trainings cost money. But these are heartfelt recommendations for the school to go forward and to prosper. And lastly, the staff need to be taken care of. God bless, there's a Saraswati Corps. She has about seven jobs. One of them is human resources. That's just not reasonable. She can't do all that. So even to do human resources takes staff. And so that's just a brief summation of how Miri Kiri is also a work in progress. I mean, how it physically has flourished now from that dry place it used to be into just a very beautiful place is a marvel to behold. But I think we need some advocacy with the Sri Singh Sabha board just to impress upon it the importance of Miri Kiri Academy, but also to really go forward in a positive way. Miri Kiri needs some structural work as well. And with the year off, perhaps that'll be a good time to do that. So that's just finishing that topic. Khalsa Council, God bless. You know, people sometimes I did visit once the Khalsa Council. I was in the Bhai Sabha's section when the Bhai Sabha first became Bhai Sabha. But I really haven't had any serious experience on the Khalsa Council or on the Sri Singh Sabha board. But some people are telling me that, you know, present and past members that there's work to be done there as well. that sometimes the Khalsa Council, or let's say the city Singh Sabha, that's where the power resides, is a little bit ingrown, a little bit American-centric. There's a kind of a power axis that runs between Herndon and Espanola. That can be problematic, especially if you're dealing with a global organization with a global membership. That needs to be worked on, and you know, we really have to be humble. The higher you go, the more humble you have to be. And power seeking really doesn't belong there. I think all the members are elected. How to solve that? Well, the best thing I can know is prayer. But maybe some dialogue. People need to talk to each other, and people need to speak amongst each other. I just got a letter. I think many of us might have got that letter from the president of the Sri Singh Sab Corporation, Guru Jodha Singh, and he's suggesting we all join in trusting our goodwill rather than impugning our goodwill, rather than doubting our goodwill. We all want this thing to work. We need to be humble, though, to do it. We need to communicate well. I have the three remaining topics, just four, let's say, are I want a little bit about subliminal racism. Another is unresolved trauma, non-Prakash center stage view on that. And a new development about Black Lives Matters. And then we'll go into teaching Kundalini Yoga under the current climate. If you have another topic, any of you, whether the panelists or other speakers.
Could I add to what you were saying there about the caste council? It sounds like sort of giving up on them a bit.
Not really.
Is one flaw that the I think that we have as an organization is that the older heads are holding on to power. They're holding on to authority. They're holding on to that, whether it's because of the finances are backed by it or the status is connected to it for whatever reason, whether it's the status or the money or whatever, or both. We need to have people who are younger, very young in this organization, who are taking charge. And especially with the abuse matter, all those people who are complaining now, we should invite them in and say, hey, okay, guys, we want to move forward with this. We want you to help us move forward with this. You'll be compensated in whatever way. Why don't you get together, form a group, and let us find some resolution from this in the way that you think it should be. Not the way in which we want to impose on them and bully them into being. But let's say, I'm not sure how many people, but let's say there were 20, 30, 40, 50, whatever number of women or young people who felt they were mistreated. Let them become part of it. So this way they become part of the solution and not so much part of a problem for us. So considering the Khalsa Council, I would say the same thing. Introduce more younger people into the world organization.
Good point. I mean, I think the median age of the Khalsa Council is it 70? It must be. I mean, it's way, way up there. And you know, I think in getting young people to be engaged, anybody who tries to do that job is going to perhaps encounter some of the same obstacles I found in getting people to get on this panel. You know, because people are so traumatized, maybe they've written off the whole thing and don't even want to be associated with it. But I think it's an excellent idea of Topsing, and hopefully it can work. Namprakashkar?
Yeah, I agree that it's a really excellent idea to listen very attentively and to invite the people who are very angry with this organization and with Yogi Bhajan, and really, and I think even if, like when I'm working with psychotherapy clients, I work a lot with women who've been sexually abused. I always believe them, even if there's a part of me that is holding that, you know, this story could be being remembered differently to how it actually happened because of the trauma and PTSD. But in that moment when I'm listening to the story, it is, you know, this is the best version that they can, the best story they can kind of cognitively tell about what's happened to them, and there's a reason for telling it. And if that can be really heard, if that can really land with me, then healing can start to happen, because it's only when you've, you know, been really able to find a narrative for the story that you can start to heal. So I think that there is a danger, however, of anger is like, I see it as like a middle level on the path to healing. So it's, if we look at, like, if you know about the theory of the vagal nerve, you know, the in polyvagal theory, the vagal nerve, Jyoti Bhajan called it the mind nerve, I think. And at the bottom of this ladder of the vagal nerve, in one, when it's in its state of most distress, in the dorsal vagal nerve, you're dissociated and you're in a freeze state. And there's no mobilization to heal. And I think that's where a lot of these women have been until Premkar's book. And I think, same with Miri Piri, you know, it's not been able to, there's been no ability to share the stories and be really heard and believed. And so they've stayed in this dorsal vagal dissociated place with it. Now they're beginning to mobilize and move into like a sympathetic state where there's fight or flight is possible. And they're really in fight. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, when you go on these, on that Facebook group, it, you know, there's a lot of mention of Kali and Durga and the fight, tremendous.
The warrior goddesses, the warrior goddesses.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is to be completely honored. And that's not the highest state of healing. There's a place that needs, they need to reach the ventral vagal system where they're into a state of more neutrality, compassion, curiosity for the other side. You know, there's no curiosity in that group about, well, if Jyoti Bhajan did these things, what was happening for him? And I've just been on the trainers forum the last 3 days, 300 people who are in the academy, you know, on training teams from, I'm an, just an intern, but, you know, lots of lead trainers and professional trainers. And I was really pleased with this, these 3 days. There was a lot of really good listening happening and a lot of people who are really in that ventral vagal state of being able to be curious. A lot of the first generation teachers really inviting, like Aftab Singh is saying, to, you know, the younger generations to come forwards and say, how is it for you? And how do you see us being able to go forwards with teaching what Yogi Ji gifted us and not losing all the preciousness of his genius as we go forwards? So I think it's important that whilst we invite people who've been affected by the sexual abuse and people who've been affected by the allegations as well, it's triggered their stories, maybe, that kind of thing. Anywhere where the patriarchal paradigm of the Piscean age is still lingering, you know, through the Miri Piri Academy, through 3HO, that that the angry people don't get so much freedom that they can hijack the whole thing. Because this is just I see this as being a really important growthful period where they come through the sympathetic system into the ventral system. But so when I'm working with women who've been sexually abused, sometimes, you know, for many, many years as young girls, it's great to see them being angry, but I begin to realize that their therapy is coming to an end when I begin to hear them be able to speak with compassion about their abuser. When they can begin to say, I wonder what was going on for dad, uncle, so-and-so, that they could do this. And they begin to be more curious about that, and then I think real healing is happening, because then it really won't matter whether we've got Jyoti Bhajan's pictures on our studio walls and we quote him or you know, because real healing will have happened whilst people are still being triggered, that we're not, that that healing is not complete yet. And so I think it's important that these the anger doesn't get a chance to be destructive, that it's clean, it can be spoken about. Really clean anger is a very powerful place to be, right? Oh, Yogi Bhajan used it quite a lot in his
I think Aristotle said that anger is a very powerful force, but very few people can use it intelligently. And Yogiji was very good with that. Very good with that. So let's go, again, there's three more topics. Just very quickly, I talked about this before. This is my big thing these days. I wrote an article, you can find it at gurupatasingh.com/astory. My parents are German, right? So I take racism very, very seriously. And one of my challenges was to learn Punjabi. And it was very hard, but now I can do it. And I just find, I think I've already given this talk before, haven't I? About reaching people's hearts through their language. And basically, you know, I was joking with my son the other day, you know, basically we're kind of a white supremacist organization, by appearance at least. You know, all these whiteys here wearing their whites, it looks pretty bad. We don't have the hoods, but we're pretty close, pretty close. And I think, you know, there can be a sense of complacency, you know, oh, I'm not racist, but, you know, there are people who wouldn't come today. And, you know, they pick it up. They'll pick it up before you do. And they come into a room of 3HOers, they're all pink skinned, they can pick up the racism. And in fact, there's a member from the Espanola community just wrote a piece. She's an Indian, married a black fellow, and she had a very bad experience, and she wrote about it. I can direct you to that. So it's there. I know it's there. Ruby, who was in our last series of presentations, she talked a bit about it. I mean, we have work to do. And so I won't say much more. Punjabi Sikho, ji. I mean, learn Punjabi, for heaven's sake. Next, unresolved trauma. Have we covered that? Anybody else wants to talk about unresolved trauma, institutional trauma, individual trauma? We pretty much covered that, haven't we? You know, I'm going to do Aftab Singh Ji. I think your suggestion is so great. I know you're burned with the Khalsa Council. You're burned with those guys. But if you'd like, you can have input. I'd be happy to send, because I'm on reasonable terms with, good terms with Krishna. I think I'm on good terms with Guruka Singh. And they're both on that board. I think your suggestion is excellent. I'd like to write them that. I'll cite you. And if you have any input into, you know, that recommendation, I welcome your input.
I don't think I'm the best person to cite on that, because I'm not really very much liked by KRI trade show organization anymore. There are a couple of people there who would like to see me in jail, actually.
you too?
I have unsubscribed from every single newsletter, notification, and email from every entity, except the Sikh minister's part. So okay,
I won't cite you. I won't cite you then.
Yes. So don't cite
it's Namkar's idea, right? Just joking.
Just make an idea from anybody.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I've had a lot of conflicting, I still do actually have some conflicting unresolved matters with them, which I think I'm right about and they think I'm not.
Fine. Okay.
Yeah. Especially with teacher training and stuff like that.
Anybody?
I just wanted to jump in with something that came up at the trainers forum these last few days about, there was one of the breakout rooms that got a large number of people attending, was about separating out KRI from the umbrella organizations, from Sri Singh Sahib Kaur. And I don't know whether Namkar could speak to that or... but it was attracting a lot of interest that...
Why separate?
I'm not the best person to speak about this, but the arguments for separating it out was that one of the reasons was to separate it out from Sikh Dharma, that we didn't need Kundalini Yoga linked to Sikh Dharma. They could be two separate entities. That instead of being a non-profit organization under Sri Singh Sahib Kaur, it could be independent and responsible to its members. So those are the two big.
Carol is already a separate organization from Sikh Dharma, so that's an interesting discussion that must have been had. But I wanted to speak for a moment back to Mitty Pitty, in that I haven't heard that a lot of the kids who went to the school, older kids who abused younger kids, I haven't heard a forum where they are addressing that and apologizing with the kids they abused, because it wasn't just teachers and staff who abused kids. It was kids who abused younger kids generally, from some of the horror stories I've heard. And I think that they have work to do also. They may be angry and blaming from their experiences, but they were also, some of them, part of the problem from what I understand and what I've heard. So it's a pretty involved situation, because if it happened to you, maybe you feel justified doing it when you're older. And I know that some of the older kids had to play the role of protecting younger kids. And then they were put in that uncomfortable situation, which they shouldn't have had to be in either. So there's a lot of trauma on many levels. And I did not listen to all those hours in which the second generation spoke. So maybe they have been addressing this. But if they haven't, I hope that they will own up to their own bullying that they did, and why they did it, and apologize to the kids and the parents who they abused. The other thing I thought was interesting is that a lot of the second generation who have claimed different kinds of abuse at the school turned around and sent their own kids to the school. I don't understand that. How bad could it have been if they sent their children back to the school that was so horrible? So this is confusing to me. There must have been enough good things at the school that they could have overlooked it. Again, another issue and something I'm not that involved with. I have a stepson who went there, and I've heard a lot from him and worked out, between him and his father and I, a lot of that and his anger at us for sending him there. And then we asked him, well, what were the good things about going there? And there were a lot of good things that he felt that he also got out of going. So anyway, on that level, but in terms of the KRI Sikh Dharma issue, my personal opinion is, KRI is already a separate nonprofit. 3HO is a separate nonprofit. IKYTA is an association under the umbrella of 3HO. Sikh Dharma is its own entity. So they already are separated. And I would think that I think KRI has a very big decision coming up as to what they're going to do. I don't know if they're waiting for the results of the Olive Branch, but there's a lot of pressure for them to drop Yogi Bhajan out of the picture, and they're going to have to decide whether they're going to do that or not. That's, I think, the main issue at hand. And in terms of teaching Kundalini Yoga, I'd like to address that. For myself, it's very, very easy. I do not believe any of the stories.
Can we just wait a minute? That's the last subject. We're almost there.
Okay, we'll go back. Sure.
But thank you. And to give a bit of credit, I did hear some. I heard very little of the testimonial from the Miri Piri youngsters. And there were a couple that said, yes, I was abused, then I abused the youngsters. I'm just passing it on, and I'm sorry. So if you have had that revelation. I just want to share a bit of good news. I think he's the president of the Sri Singh Sabha Corporation, Guru Jodha Singh. I mean, he was in the news for me twice. Once he sent a letter, I think I just got it today, that in fact there is a court case now in Los Angeles that one of the complainants has launched a few days ago, so he's keeping us abreast. But some good news from Krishna Singh in Espanola. He's telling me that in Minnesota, Black Lives Matters, George Floyd, is it? Yeah, George Floyd was killed, right? And he had a funeral in Texas, and Guru Jodha Singh went there as a representative of us, and made some really good connections. And Krishna Singh said he was given an interview, an hour and a half interview, which he videotaped, and that he's now editing for, I didn't catch what the organization is. But the next is that he was invited to go to Minnesota, and he's going to speak with the Black community up there. And if you don't know, Guru Jyoti Singh is African American. And so it just looks like there's an interesting opening there. I mean, the Nation of Islam has made inroads with the Black community in America for many years. And we've just sort of sit back. I mean, we've had Krishna with us, Guru Jyoti, haven't really done much outreach in the Black community, but this might be a interesting time, you know, just even as we're getting attacked in one way, going out into a very specific community, providing hope and guidance and empowerment in another way. So anybody, anything on that? And then we're on to the last topic. Okay, so Namkar, go ahead.
Anyway, as I was saying, for me, when I teach Kundalini Yoga or participate in a teacher training, it's very clear for me personally how to present Yogi Bhajan because of my personal experiences with him for 30 years. I don't believe any of the accusations made against him. I can understand that some of the women that may have said that there was inappropriate statements or behavior may have experienced it that way because of what Avtar Singh said, that, you know, if you experience it that way, then yes, you feel betrayed, you feel abused. But in terms of the more serious sexual allegations, I know all the women and I don't believe any of the stories. I would never believe any of them over Yogi Bhajan, knowing him as well as I know him. There's just no doubt in my mind that that's not the person he was. So for me, when I teach, you know, I still can 100% give him credit for Kundalini Yoga, for the way of life he taught us, for all the things he brought us, for the husband he gave me, for the dog he gave me, for so much. There's an insurmountable, indescribable amount of gratitude I feel in my heart for him. And that's all I can say when I teach. And I know for teachers who weren't as close to him, didn't have as much personal experience or never met him at all, that is, you know, it's more of a difficult choice. But I think that we've all heard in the social media a lot from the women who are accusing him. And I think that the teachers out there need to hear a lot from the women who aren't accusing him and who say, I was with him alone in many, many circumstances where something could have happened and nothing happened. He was never anything but a gracious, fatherly, loving teacher. And if they hear that a lot, that could help maybe them decide, who do I believe? Which teachers do, because he's not here to say for himself. So who do I believe? These 12 teachers who say they knew him and nothing happened and they don't believe it, or these 12 women who are saying something happened? So, you know, everyone's gonna have to decide that for themselves based on who they know, what teachers they know, who they trust, and what they feel in their own heart, maybe from their relationship they have with Yogi Bhajan through a dream, through the Kundalini Yoga, through meditating on his picture, through their intuition. What do they believe and how do they want to present that?
Unmute. Anand Prakashkar, you never met Yogiji. Do you want to add anything to that? How do you teach Kundalini Yoga?
Well, I'm reflecting on, I haven't changed the way I'm teaching a huge amount. I still mention him and I still quote him. I haven't done the Tritakum meditation since the allegations came out, I have to say. I haven't been that controversial yet. I think it's been a really great thing for these allegations to come out, regardless of whether he did them, because I think it's given a chance to really reset us onto a more adult path of not idealizing him, because he always said to not do that. He said, "Don't, I'm not the guru." And yet, wherever we've put him on a pedestal, we'll have been hurt by these allegations. And so it's giving us a chance to reset on that and bring the guru into our own hearts. So for me, if he did it, then, you know, I'm going to search deeper for the abuser. That some part of me is not healed yet, and I'm going to do ho'oponopono, you know, please forgive me, I'm sorry, thank you, I love you, you know, and keep that in my heart, and see what healing is possible, and to keep a sense of, you know, we would give, we would want dignity for all, right? We would, even the lowest of prisoners in a jail somewhere, if they were being mistreated, we would say they should have their dignity. So I don't see why Yogi Bhajan should be stripped of his dignity, whether he did this or not. And I have to say, I don't know. And I think that's a very, you know, it's good for us to be able to say we don't know, because in our narcissistic communities, the white patriarchy, which I'm afraid the British are largely responsible for around the world, we're not very good at saying I don't know. We like things very black or white, you know. So I was watching a comedian doing a sketch the other day where he came out, it's a black comedian, and he came out saying, "Well, I don't know about this idea of calling me black," and he put a paint chart against his skin, you know, and he was saying, actually, he says, "I think I'm chocolate love," and he went to the white woman in the audience and he said, "And I don't think you're white, I think you're peach Melba." You know, and I thought, yeah, well, there's many very, you know, we're just so rich, aren't we, as a species, so. That's where I'm at with.
Thank you. Aftab Singh, how do you teach Kundalini? How do you mention Yogi Bhajan in your class?
I talk about Yogi Bhajan all the time because he is my spiritual teacher. And he is the reason why I'm alive here in a lot of ways. But I do not teach Kundalini Yoga as taught by Yogi Bhajan trademark. I'm not part of the franchise in that way. So I have a lot of issues with that. And I've brought some of that up with Namkar before and KRI. And I believe the system is very flawed, and it encourages, actually will encourage in the future more abuses the way it is structured now. But my teacher and the way in which I've learned from him is fantastic. His teachings are great. They're the best teachings in the world as far as yoga goes, as far as I'm concerned. So I will always teach Kundalini Yoga as taught by Yogi Bhajan without the trademark after it. So this is what I do. Right now I do teacher training. I train people with certification. It's different from spiritual teacher training. It's just teacher training to get certified. It's worse than the KRI system, the one I'm using. The KRI system is a system where we churn out people in a factory. We have a mass production factory rolling off teachers, and not really making spiritual teachers. So I'm kind of like involved with that, with the studios and stuff around where I am. But when it comes to the Kundalini Yoga teaching on a one-on-one basis, I teach as Kundalini Yoga, as taught by Yogi Bhajan, just without the trademark.
Good, Aftab Singh. Thank you for sharing that. I teach Kundalini Yoga as well as taught by, I don't get the KRI certification. Frankly, KRI doesn't give me much respect. They have, the reviewers have reviewed and given a seal of approval to a couple of books, but I am just the lowliest of the lowly. No credit was given for the years I had to immerse myself. Guru's biography. I've immersed myself, just taught very few classes. I originally was given my so-called certification. I was told to go to Winnipeg and start an ashram in 1974 after my teacher training, which was first you go to Toronto, you do your daily sadhana. I don't think that's a requisite anymore, daily sadhana. But we did daily sadhana, teach a class a week, and, you know, no booze, no women, no no craziness. Get married, I was married at 20. And you know, go to Washington, D.C., and the idea was work your heart out, you know, do your sadhana every day, and go to the restaurant in the morning, and wash dishes or whatever it is, and come back around midnight, and then start again. You can survive that, you can go start an ashram in Timbuktu. And so that was the deal. But, you know, frankly, I don't care about certificates. Yogiji didn't have parade his certificate. In fact, he wrote his own certificate, and U.S. Customs asked him about it. Yeah, definitely I teach Guru Vidya Yoga as he taught, and I'm not shy about it. I make my own certificates. I have my own organization here, and I'm not shy about that. I don't need Vircharan Singh or anybody, mostly a stranger to me in New Mexico, signing on for me. I don't care for that. And I've been to New Mexico. I've been to a lot of places where go to morning sadhana, there's nobody there. I know KRI once had a 40-day deal where apparently all the employees were going to do sadhana every day. I thought to myself, must be a problem here. Why are they saying they're going to do that? Must be some issue. But anyway, I think Aftab Singh, you know, just follow the standard yogi bhajan set. The standard is very high. And I'm personally troubled. I don't understand, and perhaps Namkar being more of a, you know, spent time in New Mexico, understand what the hell went on that Yogiji didn't commission a biography 20 years before his passing. It can be submitted 10 years before his passing, and 20 years after his passing, still there's not the go-ahead to publish the thing. Whereas I was saying yesterday, I mean, the model I used was the Prabhupada biography, the founder of Krishna Consciousness. His biography, and a beautiful one, came out 3 years after his passing. So there's something very twisted, either organizationally or psychologically. Something is weird. I'm happy to be the standard carrier of Yogi Bhajan's biography, but I wonder, you know, and the young people will tell you, you know, we have a problem not only in Espanol but everywhere, but worshiping rather than aspiring to being 10 times greater. We have an issue that I can see, you know, in merchandising and making products out of these teachings rather than treating it as a mission, which is how I came to it, as Aftab Singh came to it. I think most of us came to it as a mission rather than a marketplace where we buy products and buy services. I'm still just gobsmacked that there hasn't been, whereas BBG was able to publish a biography, in Punjabi, a biography the year after Yogiji's passing, that the organization, whether we call it Sikh Dharma International or pick a name, no arms of that organization saw fit to publish that. It may be something personal. I'm not liked in New Mexico. I don't know, and I don't really care, but I'm still gobsmacked by it, and I think that needs some fixing in somebody's head. Namkar, do you have any input on it?
Well, I just wanted to say, having read the...
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead. Speak.
I just wanted to say thank you for the... I've read the autobiography, got so much from it and told so many people stories from it. It seems a shame that it can't be made more widely known. I just wanted to speak to this putting Yogi Bhajan on a pedestal. I think we're an organization, we're a community that's growing up. And part of one of the stages they talk about in psychotherapy terms of growing up is the idealization stage. You know, children around that kind of preteen stage need to idealize their parents. So you get 7-year-olds saying, you know, when I grow up, I'm going to marry you, mummy, you know. And as Satkar Tara said in the chat, you know, Yogi Bhajan never said, I don't know. He was like my father, but always knew. And I adopted that way. And I think that's been a really good way to start growing up. You know, we idealize somebody and we want to be like them and step into their shoes. But then you know, that we're probably now moving into teenager rebellious, you know, throw all that out and we don't want anything to do with this old, you old fogies. And hopefully we're going to, you know, keep transitioning as a family together to come into that. Yeah, actually there's some really great bits, and there's some bits that in our world now, in the, you know, in this decade doesn't work anymore. You know, and let's look at what's current. And
great, thank you.
I kind of feel sad that we've lost so much of what we had in the beginning. When you put that song on, that I Love 3HO song during the break, which is a little bit of a corny song, I admit, but it brought me back to the early days and how idealistic we really all were then. And we lived in ashrams, which was uncomfortable in so many ways, but probably a good group learning experience, because you can't get to, you know, infinite consciousness without group consciousness, Yogi Bhajan told us, and so we grew through that. Yes, I was there to set up a lot of the standards for teachers and teacher training, but I am not happy with what's happening at CARE-I now either. I'm also not involved in it at all, since I was fired in 2006 when the UI board fired about, I don't know, 30 or 40 people and gave themselves all those salaries. And so, you know, a lot of the people that are there now are not people that the Sri Singh Sabha appointed to the jobs. And as I said, I think some of them are struggling to keep the standard, and some of them have kind of made it too commercial or looking too much at numbers of students and money, et cetera. And it's a tough balance. It's a tough balance to create a program and a standard internationally and not have it become somewhat institutionalized. And yet, you know, that is what he wanted us to do. But I understand also, Aftab, like the way you're explaining how when we were just thrown into living in ashrams or having to go work for a business or move to a country you didn't like or marry someone you didn't want to marry, all those kind of ways that he trained us to overcome our own insecurities, fears, prejudices, et cetera, were invaluable. And that's not something that we necessarily do in teacher training or even as teachers of Kundalini Yoga. So how to bridge those gaps, I don't know. And then in terms of, I did ask the Sri Singh Sabha once, sir, The Man Called the Sri Singh Sabha is a wonderful book, but it only goes up to a certain time in the history of your life. And he said, well, you'll write the next one. And I never really took that as like a part of my mission. Because I guess it was because my husband told me something once, which I really believe. He said, if you ask the Sri Singh Sabha something and you got an answer, that was important. If he told you something that you didn't ask him about, that was super important, because he saw it as something you needed to do to fulfill your destiny. You asking him was, you know, you're thinking of what you need to do in your life at any particular moment. He saw destiny. So part of me felt like, okay, that's got to go on the list. But I was also at the time, you know, doing IKYTA and CARE-I for a long time, and it wasn't the first thing on my list. I'm actually working with another author, editing with her biography of the Sri Singh Sabha. And we now have Gurfateh Singh's, which is also very beautiful and available digitally and by his generosity free digitally. So I kind of feel like I'm fulfilling that role by helping my colleague, my friend, write her book. But in any case, I may sound like I'm idealizing Yogi Bhajan. I can't help it. I had experiences with him that were so profound and so amazing that I can't not talk about them that way. Of course, I know he was human, and he admitted many times mistakes that he himself made over the years. He even apologized to me once about my first marriage, which he encouraged, and I could say pushed me into doing, but of course, ultimately, it was my choice. And he apologized to me about that when it was over. So it's not that I see him as perfect, but I see so much incredible beauty. I've never seen another being like him, is all I can say. And if that's idealizing him, so be it.
So, you're in love, it sounds like. Are you in love?
I'm in love with the husband he gave me, that's for sure.
Well, you can be in love with your teacher in different ways, different energies.
I totally love my teacher. He once said to me, in between my marriages, when I was feeling kind of low, he said to me, you're mine and you're divine. I take that as an incredibly high compliment, not as a sexist remark.
Well, I agree.
And so, Namkar, I really hope that you didn't hear me saying you shouldn't tell your stories, because they're beautiful and, you know, they're touching my heart, and please keep telling your truth.
I didn't hear that from you at all, no. Thank you.
I agree with Namkar, is that, you know, you need to have the teacher. I don't agree so much with Nam Prakashka that you shouldn't put him on a pedestal. It's okay to have him as a pedestal. He's the teacher, he's the leader, he's the founder, he's everything. I sort of disagree with Namka that KRI is separate. It's not. I mean, all the guys who are in KRI are in the CASA Council, and the CASA Council is on the board, and the board is intermixed with the EPS, and the EPS is intermixed with the Akala security, all intermixing. So there's a lot of interbreeding going here. So I think the best way forward really is to have everything separate, completely separate, a separate Korean Academy, a separate Library of Teachings, a separate KRI training, book publication area, a separate Sikh Dharma with exactly individual and independent oversight on each one, completely unrelated. And it could be overseen maybe by the CASA Council, if they can get the acts together and have young people there to give advice and some guidance. I think otherwise it's gonna be corrupt forever. It's not gonna get out of the hole. There's so much corruption in the teacher training in the level 1, 2, and 3 hierarchy system that it's not gonna go anywhere. It's not gonna get people into a spiritual mastery. We're just gonna churn people out. They're going to have problems, going to be involved with money and status. And we will just keep on repeating these same mistakes that we've done before. So in a way, I don't care because I'm not involved. I'm not getting any newsletters from what's happening. But I do care in a way, because this is the legacy of my teacher, you know, so in that way. So take it from whatever that means. So. I'd like to say thanks a lot for you, Guru Father, for hosting this, these seminars, having us here. And I know our time is almost up, and I appreciate everybody coming out and listening and sharing. Thank you.
Well, you know, that's why I dragged you on board. You have to admit I dragged you, you know. You didn't originally want to join us, but I know that he cherishes his legacy, and he's a part of that legacy. He himself said, you know, he feels that he's a very true student of Yogiji. And so we're all a part of that legacy, and we can try and you know, do our own thing and not relate to those crazy people over there. But you know, that organization, God bless her, you know, Namkar, that she started, Yogiji gave it the name Ikta. And Punjabi Sikho Ji, you know, study your Punjabi. Ikta means oneness. It does. You know, every once in a while, it's good to know a little Punjabi. Ik Onka. Ik means one. And so I do pray and hope that we can stick together. I do, personally, I feel that the youngsters, now they're 40, whatever you're old, but the people that are younger than us in this movement, or even the ones that are potentially in this movement, do have some realistic grievances. The CASA Council is way too old, and we don't support and we don't nurture and groom, if that's the word, people to move into leadership positions. And of course they're resentful. Of course they're resentful if they're promised work and they're not given it. Of course they're resentful if we give them this beautiful, idyllic education in Amritsar and just plop them in the swamp afterwards and don't look after them properly. So I mean, the first solstice I was at, it was the winter solstice in Florida in 1972, and Yogiji said, mark my words. So I don't remember that much. It was cold. I didn't prepare properly. We held up our arms a lot. But the other thing I remember was when he said, mark my words, he talked about in defense of Swami Satchidananda, his good friend. And he said, Swami Satchidananda, his secretary, is accusing him of sexual impropriety. And this is how Americans, this is how you Westerners bring down your spiritual teachers. So I made a mental note. And I don't personally think Yogiji's capable of that. I don't think, you know, Gurtej Singh said it well, and he was guard outside Yogiji's bedroom door for many years. So he said, you know, I don't think Yogiji woke up in the morning and said, well, who am I going to abuse today? I don't think he was like that at all. That's not the character profile. But I am happy in a sense that some of the what we call young people are using this sexual allegations to get our attention. Because boy, they get our attention, and maybe completely bogus, but we need to pay attention to that, those generations, more than one generation now, and fostering them and nurturing them and grooming, if that's the word, you know, into leadership positions, because they've been promised a lot. You know, you said our future is golden, we're going to be leaders, we'll be rich, and I think it's a multi-generation project, much as Yogiji said, you know, Moses, when he could have crossed the Sinai in 40 days. We took 40 years because it was a character building process, taking slaves and building them into leaders. And you're going to lose people for sure. And it's going to be hard for sure. But that's the way I see it. And I'm glad, you know, people have been pricked, their eyes have been pricked open. And heaven help us with, you know, how this thing goes. I hope that everybody stays in a spirit of unity and of taking great pride in this legacy. And for heaven's sake, as Namprakash says, keep Yogiji's dignity, even if you've never met him, or, you know, everybody deserves at least that much. So any final words from anybody? Then we'll sing Long Time Son. Okay. Interesting. Heart goes out. Beautiful. You can always email me afterwards if anybody has any questions. We'll be sending out the recording, God willing, later in the day. Shall we unmute and sing Long Time Son? Come on up top. We want to hear your beautiful voice. There we go.
Yeah, okay. There we go.
All right. May the long time sun shine upon you. All love surround you. And the pure light within you guide your way on. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on. Guide your way. Guide your way on, Sat Nam.
Sat Nam. Thank you, everyone.
Creator. Thank you, Creator, for this webinar. Thank you for these teachings, for this legacy. Thank you all. Thank you for the technology that kept us together. May we live as healthy, happy, and holy by your grace. Sat Nam.
Sat Nam. Very good.